so much again for participating in the steering committee. It's nice to see you all here today. What we're going to do right now is just basically welcome an introduction, very similar to last time. And I'd like to just go around the table and have everybody introduce themselves, say where you're from, and then we also need to verbally state whether we have any disclosures of conflict of interest or bias. And I'll start. I'm Arden Morris. I'm the Chief of Colorectal Surgery at University of Michigan, and I have no conflicts of interest.
I'm meeting with the float. I'm happy to be here today, and I want to add my thanks to all for coming. I'm formerly a cardiac surgeon. I was Chief of Cardiac Surgery at Mass General, and I'm now the head of the physicians group there. No conflicts.
Alexis Foreman, Project Staff.
Missy Mashbar, I'm an internist and with the Department of Neurosurgery and the Associate Medical Director of Quality and Safety at UCLA Medical Center, and I have no conflicts.
Chris Dagel, I'm a neurologist at UCLA.
No conflicts.
Vivian Halpern, Chief of Vascular Surgery at the Carl G. Hayden Phoenix VA Medical Center, and no conflicts.
I'm Bob Sima. I'm a colorectal surgeon and vice chair of the Department of Surgery for Quality at Mayo Clinic Rochester. I have no conflicts.
Carol Wilhoit, Quality Improvement Medical Director for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois, and I have no conflicts.
I'm Howard Barnaby, an ophthalmologist from Seattle. I just joined the committee a week ago, so some understanding and sympathy will be appreciated. And I have no conflicts of interest to report.
Good morning, I'm Carla Grayling. I'm the clinical nurse specialist at perioperative services here in town at Inova Fairfax Hospital, and I have no conflict.
Dennis Rubenberg, I'm a physician assistant with St. Anthony's Primary Care and co-chair of the Quality and Safety Committee of St. Anthony's Hospital, and I have no conflicts of interest.
Hi, good morning. Curtis Collins, clinical pharmacist, infectious diseases at the University of Michigan. No conflicts.
Hi, I'm Christine Zambrecki. Good morning. I'm a nurse anesthetist, and I'm deputy executive director of the American Association of Nurse Anesthetists. And I reported a potential conflict when I agreed to participate, and that is I sit on an advisory board to a surgical information systems company.
Hi, I'm Renee Stafford. I'm the director of surgical critical care at University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. With potential conflicts is I am a member of the quality committee at SCCM, and I'm also a member of the American College of Surgeons.
Good morning. Ruth Kleintel. I'm a professor of nursing at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago and also a nurse practitioner, and I have no conflicts.
Alan Supersonic, Chair Endocrine Surgery at the Cleveland Clinic. I have no conflicts.
Terry Rogers, CEO of the Foundation for Healthcare Quality in Seattle, and I have no conflicts.
Good morning, Jim Carpenter. I'm the Chair of Orthopedic Surgery at the University of Michigan. I have no conflicts.
Hi, good morning. I'm Steve Finley. I'm a Senior Health Policy Analyst at Consumers Union. I'm the consumer representative on this panel, and I have no conflicts to report.
Rick Dutton, I'm a former trauma anesthesiologist in Baltimore, now the executive director of the Anesthesia Quality Institute in Chicago. I have no conflicts.
Peter Dillon, chair of surgery at Penn State, and I have no conflicts.
I have two microphones. I don't know what to do. Heidi Bosley, vice president of performance measures at NQF.
Jessica Weber, NQF.
Melinda Murphy, NQF.
All right, thank you, everyone. We're just going to next talk about our expectations in the process for the meeting, and this will be very familiar for most of you, maybe not all of you. Basically, our plan here is to start, as you'll see on your agenda, by talking about initially, a recap of the work to date, which Alexis and Melinda will lead. We'll talk about how to use our remote controls appropriately to vote. And we'll talk about the Phase 1 measure follow-up. There were a lot of things about the Phase 1 measures that we wanted to get more information about, and there are some votes that we postponed until we received more information. And so that has happened in the interim. we'll start by talking about Measure 300 and get the additional information from CMS that we were looking for last time. And then we'll determine whether or not our conditions are satisfied. We won't vote on this measure quite yet. We'll then go to the list on page 2 of the agenda. Sequentially vote on those measures. We will not re-present the measures, so those of you who are responsible for each of these individual measures won't necessarily need to re-present unless the group feels that it would be beneficial prior to voting. As you can see, our agenda is really full for today. We'll try and be efficient with time, but on the other hand, the reason that we're all here in person is to have a discussion, so if we need to do that, we certainly will. We also have, is it time to open the meeting? Yes, okay. So it's time to open the meeting to the public. Before we do, Dr. Morton, would you just introduce yourself to the group?
I'm John Morton. I'm an associate professor from Stanford University.
Thank you. So we're going to open to the public now, and we have several folks on the line. So we'll be okay. And in person. And so we'd like to ask you to introduce yourself.
Good morning. I'm Donna Schlossberg with the ASC Quality Collaboration. I guess I should have told her I'm a measure developer.
And those on the phone, anyone on the phone?
Foundation for Medical Quality.
I'm sorry. Say your name again, please. It did not come through well.
Yeah, Melinda Stale-Brasper.
Hi there. Anyone else on the phone?
Let's see. I think that that's about it in its turn to recap. So already we're ahead of schedule. This is great.
Okay, so for the recap, what we want to do is just quickly repeat some of the information from the last meeting, and we'll start with the project purpose. Again, when you're looking at the measures, you're looking at endorsement or continuation of measures for quality improvement and public reporting. And all these measures are around surgical patient and surgical procedures. And as part of this, there is a maintenance review of the surgery standards that were endorsed prior to June of 2008. There are some specific things that you looked at last time, asked for last time, that you will want to do again during phase two, and we'll point those out as we look at the criteria. So for the phase one measures, the first part of the agenda is to resolve any outstanding issues. You'll recall that there were some requests that you made at the time of the last in-person meeting that were resolved. The majority of them were resolved to your satisfaction during the March 31st call. And there is one that we'll hear more about today, and then you will be making recommendations related to related and competing measures that you considered in phase one, and make endorsement recommendations for the measures, the 20 measures that you considered in phase one that you determined met the four criteria that would make them eligible for consideration for endorsement. And then we'll move to the phase two measures, where you will be evaluating 38 measures against the measure evaluation criteria as you did for the phase one measures. And you'll again make recommendations related to related and competing measures. And what we talked about a bit earlier this morning is that you might not be ready to make final recommendations about related and competing measures, particularly phase two, depending on where we are in the work by that point in the day tomorrow, and again, to make endorsement recommendations. So I want to just quickly run through the criteria. Importance to measure and report is the first criterion. Remember, these are in a hierarchical fashion, and you make determinations about importance before you move to any of the others, with the understanding that if it's not important to measure and report, you probably don't want to even look at the other pieces, with exception of those measures that you might determine are topped out. And for those measures, if you determine that they are not important to be continued for endorsement because they're topped out, you will want to look at the other criteria in order to make a determination about whether or not they should go into an inactive status. You would not want to move a topped-out measure into an inactive status where it could be reactivated if you did not feel that it met all of the other criteria. So for those measures, once you make the determination it's not important, and it's not important based solely on the fact that it's topped out, we'll still go through the other criteria. And for the measures that are undergoing maintenance, a couple of the things that you will be looking for in particular is whether or not they've identified what the performance gap was, and within the performance gap, have they stratified it so you can see where disparities may be that might need to be further addressed. So you're going to be looking for data, for numbers, as well as the citations. In scientific acceptability, there are the list of things you're looking for with respect to scientific acceptability, with the fundamental piece being, are the measures reliable? Are they valid? So within that, you're going to look at the testing that's been done for reliability and validity. And again, looking at the other pieces of the information around scientific acceptability. For usability, is the extent to which the audience that is to receive the output of the measure can understand the results and will find them useful. And some of you on the work groups will recall that there were some discussions about some of the measures in terms of what is the utility to the public and how would you convey that information to the public. So those are questions that you will answer as you think about usability. Also looking at, are the measures harmonized? And again, whenever we're looking at related and competing measures, what do new measures add in terms of value to the measures that are already endorsed and available? And with the maintenance review considerations, one important piece is, are the measures that have been endorsed over time being publicly reported? And if not, what are the plans for public reporting, just as you did in phase one? Feasibility, is the information, the data required to compute the measure available? Can it be retrieved with relative ease, not a lot of additional burden, and can it be implemented? So you're looking for data that's generated as part of the process, the care process, information that's available electronically. If there are exclusions, do you have to go someplace other than the data source for the measure elements proper to get the information about the exclusion? So that's an additional burden. What are the susceptibilities to inaccuracies? And given all of the information about where the data comes from, can the strategy that's recommended for use in collecting it actually be implemented? So then, in the course of rating those criteria, the first one, as I said, was important. That's a yes-no rating. The other criteria are evaluated based on the level to which they meet the criterion, either completely, partially, minimally, not at all, or it's not applicable. and you'll get some more information as you look at how you're going to use the tool. So Jessica's going to give you information about the voting. You want to do that now or you want to do it in a bit? Okay.
So everyone should have the voting tool that they had last time. So to vote, you press the number of your choice and then send, and make sure you aim it towards me so that it picks up the vote. Make sure that, anyway. So we can go ahead and do a demonstration if you want. I'll leave the measure up that we're going to vote on first, and you should have 60 seconds to put your vote in once I start the timer. It'll be on the screen to my right. And it should give a live tally of how many votes we have. We should have 19.
Yeah,
okay. Okay, great. All right. Thanks.
Alexis.
As Melinda and Dr. Morris indicated, we will start off with outstanding issues from Phase 1, and we'll begin with a brief introduction from the measure developer for Measure 300. The committee suggested changing the measure from 6 a.m. to 24 hours, and CMS had to go back to their expert panel to provide that suggestion. So we will hear results from that meeting, and if they are able to make your modification. Then following that discussion, as Dr. Morris indicated, we will make final recommendations on 15 of the Phase 1 measures, and unless someone indicates we need to discuss some of the measures, we will just go straight to the voting. As Melinda indicated, we will then go into Phase 1 related and competing measures, and we will have a brief discussion on each of those measures. And this slide is just to indicate we pulled four measures from a current project that's going on, the Pediatric Cardiac Surgery Project, and we brought them over for competing and related, which we will have a discussion on tomorrow at 1:30 during our Phase 2 related and competing discussion. And these measures are related to two of our maintenance measures, 0339, Pediatric Heart Surgery Mortality, and 0340, Pediatric Heart Surgery Volume. So we'll discuss that in more detail tomorrow.
Great, so is this the appropriate time for, is it Dale to?
Yes.
Okay, for Dale Bradford to go ahead and talk with us about the additional information regarding Measure 300.
All right, good morning. Can you hear me okay?
It's actually rather quiet. Can we, is there a way to turn up the volume or? Dale, we can barely hear you, so we're going to work on the volume here.
All right. Just let me know if you're having trouble. Can you hear me?
Can you hear him down at that end of the table? Everybody? Anybody who cannot hear him? Okay. Yeah, why don't you go ahead and proceed.
All right. Well, good morning, everyone. After the last meeting, we, as you know, the committee asked us to take the measure back and consider some changes to the measure. I think the primary change that was requested at the time was that we look, rather than the previous performance metric, which the date element was collected of 6 a.m. blood sugar, or blood sugar that was collected closest to 6 a.m., that we collect the blood sugar at 24 hours. We took the discussion back to two different groups. First, I think many of you are aware that the Society of Thoracic Surgeons has published a practice guideline series on blood glucose management during adult cardiac surgery. It was published in Annals of Thoracic Surgery in 2009 and provides evidence-based recommendations for blood sugar control in cardiac surgery patients. So we had a conversation with several of the authors of that guideline, and then we met with the Surgical Care Improvement Project Infection Technical Expert Panel, who invited Dr. Tony Fanari, and I believe Dr. Richard Engelman was also on the call, both authors on the FDF guideline, to participate with the technical expert panel. So let me just highlight just a couple of things. First, there's still strong support for the measure. We feel that, you know, based on the conversation with the technical panel and FDF, that there's strong evidence to support glucose control in cardiac surgery patients. Secondly, when you look at the FDF guideline, they make explicit Class 1A recommendations around glucose control, and I'll just read the one recommendation that's relevant here. Patients with and without diabetes with persistently elevated blood sugar should receive IV insulin infusions to maintain the serum glucose less than 180 milligrams per deciliter for the duration of their ICU care. Again, they made a Class 1A recommendation. So, after discussion with the technical panel, what we were trying to figure out was a way to capture, you know, some information about blood sugar control in the ICU without too much burden for the hospitals. So the recommendation of the technical panel, along with representatives of the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, is that we simply ask the hospital to capture a data element that looks at whether any of the blood sugars between 18 and 24 hours were greater than 180 milligrams per deciliter. So we would only look at a single time frame. We would not look at 2 days as we have in the past. The feeling of the committee, and particularly the input of FDS, is that by 18 to 24 hours after surgery, the blood sugars should be controlled, and the Class 1 recommendation is that those blood sugars be below 180. And so I know Tori Lynch and Wanda Johnson are on the call. They can perhaps give you a little better description of the data elements that we're testing, but it would simply look at whether any blood sugars in that time frame, 18 to 24 hours after surgery and time, were greater than 180 milligrams per deciliter. Wanda, do you want to add any comments?
The only thing that we also added is if there was no blood sugar between 18 and 24 hours after anesthesia end time, that they would record the highest one between 12 and 18 after, just in case there were no blood sugars at the 18 to 24 hour mark.
So that's our recommendation for the changes. That met the approval of our technical expert panel. And again, had a great deal of input from the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, the guideline panel that gave the Class 1A recommendation for blood sugar control.
Does the group feel as though our conditions are satisfied?
Just want to clarify a couple things. First of all, that was not Class 1A evidence they cited. They cited all patients with diabetes undergoing cardiac surgical procedures should receive an insulin infusion in the operating room and for at least 24 hours postoperatively to maintain serum glucose levels less than 180. That's evidence level B. So just to make sure we're clear on what they said.
Look at recommendation number 7.
I'm looking at the paper right now. Recommendation for Class 1.
I read it.
I have it right here in front of me.
Yeah, recommendation number 7. I read it verbatim. Patients with and without diabetes with persistently elevated blood glucose should receive IV insulin infusions to maintain serum blood glucose less than 180 milligrams per deciliter for the duration of their ICU care, level of evidence A.
Well, if you look at the second page of that recommendation, which I'm reading it right now also, level 4, management of hypoglycemia using insulin protocols in the perioperative period recommendations, Class 1B. So all patients with diabetes undergoing cardiac surgical procedures should receive an insulin infusion in the operating room for at least 24 hours postoperatively to maintain serum glucose levels less than 180 milligrams per deciliter, parentheses, level of evidence equals B, close parentheses, period.
But I see what you're reading, but that again looks at the perioperative period, which includes the operating room, which is not what we look at. We only look at the postoperative care in the ICU. So recommendation number 7
is for 24 hours postoperatively. I just want to clarify that. It says that right there, post-operatively for 24 hours.
Well, exactly. But so this level 7, recommendation number 7 is during the ICU stay. So that's all we look at is that we do not look at intraoperative control.
Okay. So the only issue is what does it mean? Why are they going from 200 to 180 now?
Basically because we felt like we should align with the published guideline. We frankly always try to do that. We always try to make sure that we incorporate guideline recommendations for our performance metrics.
Now, what if the patient, if there's an exclusion here for patients on inotropes, is that going to be an exclusion built into it, or are they just saying any patient?
Yeah, it's all patients, and you're absolutely correct. We recognize that inotropes drive the blood sugar up, but that's all the more reason that those patients need to have IV insulin infusions to keep their blood sugars controlled. As was pointed out by the SDF committee, the inflection point for mortality, morbidity, and the infections goes up once the sugars are in excess of 180, whether it's induced by inotropes or whether they have diabetes. So those for all patients. We don't exclude patients on inotropes.
The only thing I'm a little confused about is that you're saying that it says the first in item 7.1, it says patients with and without diabetes with persistently elevated serum glucoses should receive an IV insulin infusion. So that's level A evidence. But the question is so persistently elevated. So does that mean that you're saying that all ICU patients need to have an insulin infusion to make sure, or is it patients that are persistently elevated? And the question here is you're saying you want to introduce a measure where you have to put everyone on an insulin infusion to make sure they're on insulin for 24 hours, or are you saying they have to have a blood sugar greater than 200, which may not correspond to persistently elevated? The question is here is exactly what do you want us to do? So are you saying everyone has to be on insulin infusion, or everyone has to be on it even when the evidence says it's persistently elevated, not a single measure, not a single evaluation point?
Right. Well, the recommendation for the committee was that the blood sugars between 18 and 24 hours should be 180 or less. And so we were not going to, we don't require anybody to be on insulin infusion. I'll make that very clear. We don't look at how patients are treated. We allow the hospital to control the blood sugar anyway. And if the patient's blood sugars are less than 180, there's no need for any intervention at all. But the recommendation of the committee was simply that the hospital record the highest blood sugars between 18 and 24 hours. And we looked to see whether or not it was 100 greater than 180 milligrams per deciliter.
So if they check it one time and it's 200, that's the first time, they're going to get penalized, and then they start the insulin drip appropriately. I mean, I'm just concerned about the language. It's persistently elevated. You're looking at a one-time measure.
I understand your point completely. I think it would be a rare case that somebody would check for the first time a blood sugar 18 hours after cardiac surgery. But
no, but that's
but then I understand your issue.
Arguably, the first time they check it is 18 hours after surgery, they should be dinged, because that would be
out. No, but what if it's fine multiple times and then one time it's not? I mean, which one are you going to take? Let's say they have two of them. One's higher and one, the next one within 24 hours is lower because they've adjusted the insulin.
It seems to me that there's going to be a trade-off here between the burden of data collection and the ability to assess the method to figure out if we're actually doing the right thing.
Point. Is it a good way of measuring it? Should we say, evidence of attempting to maintain insulin? I'm just saying it's a difficult measure to meet by many hospitals that keep them on insulin drips, and also the way it's written is difficult to manage. You know, the data suggests not a single blood sugar level. All the data suggests persistent elevation over a period of time. This is not a good measure for measuring that.
Well, you know, last time we had a lot of discussion about how, as it was raised before, with a 6 a.m. focus,
that a lot of hospitals were in fact putting patients on intensive insulin therapy in order to meet that 6 a.m. measure. So now we're moving to 18 to 24 hours, which again is more comprehensive, you know, definitely better than just the 6 a.m. But I think we also have to look at unintended consequences. You know, we talked before about some people potentially gaming the system to try and get that 6 a.m. with the normal values and then maybe not adhering to looking at the value and how that varies over time. I think the change is definitely, again, more comprehensive. But I guess feasibility, you know, of the question may have to be considered. I guess we won't know until we really see this in practice. Is there any data with respect to longitudinal monitoring of glucose that you have that would relate that many patients are within the range by 18 to 24 hours?
I personally don't have any of that data from the SKIP project. I believe that Tony Tenari's group and others do have considerable data on that particular topic. I would have to defer to them. I think, you know, one of the issues that we struggle with here is that that we all recognize, as with the current measure, with the 6 a.m. measure that exists currently, occasional cases will fall out even with appropriate care. We understand that. We've never said that the target of performance on the measure is 100%. So we haven't tried to build the performance measures to address every possible rare clinical exclusion to the performance measure. I think it's possible that you know, a single blood sugar between 18 and 24 hours could pop up above 180 and a case might fail. I guess that's a possibility. We recognize that. Well, we know from cardiac surgery data that 50 to 60% of all cardiac surgery patients are hyperglycemic postoperatively. So it is a big population of the cardiac surgery group that should receive insulin therapy. And it has to do with the prevalence of diabetes and the use of inotropes and all the other things that happen to these very, you know, large operations that are occurring to these patients. So that was the recommendation of the committee with a great deal of input from the Society of Thoracic Surgeons Committee also. You know, we talked about it. I know this group's talked about it. We've talked about it before. Ideally, we'd capture every single blood sugar and calculate the daily average, but that simply isn't feasible.
So, Dr. Sina, your concern is that a single value doesn't accurately reflect that integral over time, or that the rate at which it doesn't reflect it is high enough to invalidate the measure.
Well, I just think that their own literature says that it needs to be a trend of persistently elevation. And that's what the SPSS, despite how you may want to parse the words. But certainly it's better than 2 days at two separate times at 6 a.m. It's a better measure, but, you know, I just think it's not really directing at what the literature and the scientific evidence support, which is better glucose control over a period of time. And I think In the ICU setting, it's the physicians who care for these patients. You can have a patient on an insulin drip and have them at, you know, 150 for 6 hours straight and check another blood sugar, and it's 200 for no reason. And I think that's what people feel, that, you know, they're really tightly controlling these people. And there's evidence in the literature, class one evidence, that says extremely tight control in ICU patients and cardiac surgical patients increases their risk for death and sepsis. So it works both ways, and the data says a trend and persistent elevation. We're looking for a single marker in critically ill patients who are on inotropes, who have had major interventions, and who are ill patients coming in. The vast majority of them have insulin diabetes, as was mentioned, and I think it's not the ideal measure for it. Now, does that invalidate it? I think it's better than it was. But I still think it doesn't meet the scientific evidence that's available now, that it is a persistent elevation of blood glucose levels greater than 180 that have been shown to increase the risk of infection and mortality. It is not a single value.
Okay, so our role right now is to determine whether or not our condition was satisfied. Dale, would you please repeat the numerator statement for the group?
So the numerator would be patients having cardiac surgery whose blood sugars... So what we do is we capture the highest blood sugar between 18 hours and 24 hours. So it would be those patients that had a blood sugar that was 180 or less in the 18 to 24-hour time frame, recorded as their highest sugar.
So are you saying that somebody's looking at all the sugars anyway?
They're looking at those between 18 and 24 hours. They only capture one. They just look at the chart for that time frame.
So why aren't they then looking at the average if they're looking at them all anyway?
Well, that would require them to capture them all. We don't do that. So this just lets them glance at the lab or the glucometer records and capture a single value.
Okay, well then I go back to Dr. Seymour's point. If they look at it and they see the majority of the glucoses, all of them except one is high, is that really a good measure? Because you do have, if you force people to overtreat and they become hypoglycemic, again, there's consequences to that.
I completely understand that. But again, I want to make it very clear. We've never, never, ever promoted intensive insulin therapy, never, with this performance measure. Now, as we have now or as it was in the past, we have never promoted it. The American, clinical endocrinologist published guidelines about a year ago, focused on all ICU patients, not just cardiac surgery, that recommends all ICU patients' blood sugars be maintained between 140 and 180. That is the national recommendation for ICU patients. The FDS guideline is consistent with that the blood sugars simply be maintained less than 180. So I believe me, I understand the comments about unintended consequences, and I've made it very clear in multiple forums that we do not promote intensive therapy. So what we're trying to do is figure out a way to capture reasonable control of the blood sugar in a time frame after surgery when most of the expert panel, the FDS, felt that by 18 hours, the blood sugar should be reasonably controlled.
I have a question then, hypothetical. If at 18 hours the blood sugar is 150, let's say, for clinical reasons, they do. And then it's at 18 and a half hours, it's 200. And then at 19 hours, it's 150 because they corrected it. Do we fail them?
Yeah, the case would fail, as recommended.
So is that the clinical, is that what you want? You want us to be treating that as opposed to the clinical circumstances? Is that what you're asking?
So I understand the point, and that's why, excuse me, why I made the point. We understand that sometimes patients who receive appropriate care fail to measure. We understand that. The target's not 100%. It's high, and right now the national average around the current measure is in the 90% range, but some cases still have blood sugars that are elevated. I'm just reflecting the conversation of the committee to try to balance this combination of data burden with having a measure that's reasonable and consistent with the guidelines.
Dr. Martin?
I was going to say that I think the proposal is a step forward. It's something that is different from what was encountered before. I think all of us reflected some of the frustration we see in clinical practice and having to meet an arbitrary 6 a.m. Time. So I think the proposal is really a step forward in that it's capturing it within a more reasonable time frame. I think the other point is that we all agree that blood sugar should be controlled after surgery. I don't think anybody's quibble about that. I think the one point here is whether or not a single time point is reflective of the entire post-op glycemic state of the patient. I think that's really the question, and I guess I think that's one that's a little hard to figure out. There's always a balance of trying to get as much data as possible, as well as having the parsimony to get things actually done
But I think the proposal is a step forward where we don't have that arbitrary 6 a.m. time.
So I guess I'm going to ask the question, what would be enough data? You know, should we say two or more blood sugars greater than 180 or...
Could we say?
I mean, you know, what we're trying to avoid is extensive data collection, data points. We use metrics like this for data abstraction in the past where the abstractor can scan a record, and if they see a number that's above, you know, a threshold, they stop looking. They don't have to look anymore. So, you know, once we go to two or three data points, then we start to require them to look at every single sugar that occurred during that time frame.
Could you do something like 18 to 24 hours if there's a blood sugar greater than 200? Was there a correction and another blood sugar within 4 hours that was less than the goal? I mean, could you look at it that way? So it's a two-tiered system. I agree with John. I think this is a much better measure in the sense it's more realistic in the sense of what we're trying to achieve. But could you say within 18 to 24 hours, if there's above, if it's less than 180, fine, we're done. If it's above 180, was there an intervention to correct it in a reasonable time period and bring it down below 180?
One, I'm going to defer to you or Tori to think about, you know, the mechanism of capturing that. It would require additional data elements, for sure.
Right, and as we look forward to EHRs, how would you write that? If it was, if you found a level higher than 180, then you would then look for a an entry for a correction. And then you would then look for an entry for a control value. To me, it's a matter of hospital data abstraction burden. But yes, we can write specifications to address that.
We can certainly explore it.
I guess I could echo the comments that, yes, this measure, I think, is moving in the right direction. One of my concerns is that, you know, these measures are not just passive observations of a best clinical practice, but the institutions, quote, study for the test. So it does influence practice pattern. And you can very easily see some practice patterns evolve that are no good. So if you get one blood sugar that's 179 at 18 hours, are you going to quit measuring it for the next 6 hours? I mean, institutions are going to do things to game the system. And I think it's important, as Bob hinted, to craft the measure so that it really is encouraging a best clinical practice. You know, somewhat analogous to the normothermia measure in that if you may not, after surgery, that if you may not meet the temperature requirements, at least you have tried. And in this way, I agree that some type of two-tiered measure, whereas you do go just above the threshold and you've demonstrated success / attempt to correct, then that would mean that the institution is moving towards or doing their best to institute a best practice.
I just had a thought pursuing the same line, because the idea of just checking one sugar and then not checking another till 24 hours and 30 minutes just sounds too... it's a little too cynical to support a practice like that. But what if there were a sugar that was greater than the threshold, whether that's 180 or 200, and that is the trigger? And then if there are other sugars prior to 24 hours that are below the threshold, it basically gets erased. So the trigger creates a tension, and only if the subsequent sugars up to 24 hours remain elevated does the measure actually become a failed glucose control. And you don't have to look for the intervention. The intervention would be implicit in the lower sugar.
I think what we're doing here is adding additional conditions, which is absolutely fine. But Melinda, please correct me if I'm wrong. So that's something that we're sort of talking about as a group, putting additional conditions on this before we would vote on it. And that's
it will make a difference. We will not be able to vote on it today because, again, I'm going to make the assumption that they will need to go back to their technical panel to have this discussion. So we're talking about it moving out some period of time.
Okay.
We can, for just the specification change, we can figure out a way to communicate via email with the panel so we can expedite the discussion.
Okay, I think that sounds fine. Anything else that anybody wants to say about whether the conditions were satisfied on Measure 300 before we move on to voting on the other measures? All right, let's go to page 2 of the agenda. The next measure is 114, risk-adjusted post-operative renal failure. We had a lot of discussion about this previously. Does the group wish to have this re-presented, or are do you folks believe that you're ready to go ahead and vote? Okay, let's go ahead and vote. Okay, so the first question is, do you recommend this measure for endorsement, yes or no? Are we all set? That's 17 votes for yes, 2 for no, and 3 abstain, so we do recommend it for endorsement. Sorry. 1 for no, 1 for abstain. Yep. That's I definitely need eyes in the back of my head more than ever before. Measure number 115. Risk-adjusted surgical re-exploration. Is there a desire among the group to re-describe this measure or to re-present this measure?
Did we talk about this one last time? I forgot. I don't remember.
I am blanking. My memory is blanking out on this one as well. Did we actually talk about it?
So we punted on all these. Why again? Could you remind us?
The items that are here that you're looking at right now, each had some condition or request for additional information from the committee to the developer. And then on the 31st of March,
right,
those conditions were discussed in terms of whether or not they met the request requirement of the committee. And the ones that you're looking at on the 31st all met the conditions that were requested. So now the last piece, the last step, is to vote on whether or not you now, having that condition satisfied, are ready to vote on a recommendation for endorsement.
I believe most of the STS ones, the issue was disparities, right? Presenting disparity data, which they did on the phone.
And what you see on the screen up here in the shaded box is what the condition was, how the developer responded, and what the action of the committee was. So in each case, what you're going to see projected is what your condition was, the response, and your determination.
Okay, so the voting is concluded. There are 19 votes for yes,
None for no and one abstain. The next measure is measure 116, antiplatelet medication at discharge. As Melinda pointed out, the conditions will come up in the shaded box. There are a number of conditions, and during our conference call, we agreed that they were met. I think it's time to go ahead and vote. Does anybody want to discuss further? Okay. There are 20 votes for yes, none for no, and none for abstain. Measure number 118, anti-lipid treatment at discharge. Again, this was around disparities. Anybody want to discuss it? Okay. Can everybody hit their button one more time on their remote? Twenty votes for yes. Measure number 119, risk-adjusted operative mortality for coronary artery bypass graft. And again, you can see in the shaded box the condition. Everybody ready to vote? Okay. Nineteen votes for yes, one vote for no. The next measure is measure 120. This suggested operative mortality for aortic valve replacement. Again, we are looking for information on disparity. And we'll go ahead and vote. Nineteen votes for yes, one vote for no. Measure number 121, risk-adjusted operative mortality for mitral valve replacement. Again, questions about disparities, and we'll go ahead and vote. Can everybody hit the button on their remote one more time? Nineteen votes for yes, one vote for no. Item number 122 is risk-adjusted operative mortality for mitral valve replacement and coronary artery bypass graft surgery. And we'll go ahead and vote. Let's go ahead and hit the buttons one more time. This is sounding familiar. Okay. 19 votes for yes, one vote for no. Measure number 123, risk-adjusted operative mortality for aortic valve replacement and coronary artery bypass graft. Okay, and we'll go ahead and vote again. Thank you. And that's 20 votes for yes. Measure number 129 was risk-adjusted prolonged intubation ventilation. And our conditions were consideration of a change in the time limit to less than 24 hours and data on disparity. In the conference call, believe that our conditions were met. Does anybody want to discuss this?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to make one comment. I can still oppose the 24 hours, notwithstanding the complexity of medications and surgery. I think that 24 hours gives some leeway and latitude so that if you have actually a sloppy method of addressing people postoperatively, it gives you far too big a window, in fact, to practice that sloppiness. So I just register that comment.
Thank you. Anybody else? Okay. Let's go ahead and vote then. So 15 votes for yes, 4 votes for no, and 1 abstain. One of the issues that arose in our last discussion that we kept coming back to was the issue of top-out measures in which the criteria had essentially been met to an extensive degree, maybe not 100%, but pretty close to it. And this was one of those measures. We'll need to basically determine how we want to deal with that, because several of these measures may be topped out or approaching being topped out. I guess if they're approaching, it doesn't count, but if they are topped out, then we need to make a decision about whether we want to continue to endorse them in the maintenance measures. Is there more?
So the discussion at the time of the last in-person meeting was that performance was at or above 90%, but there was discussion that the committee felt that compliance should be closer to 100%. So the remaining question is, do you feel that based on the information that you have here that it should remain in an active status until it gets closer to 100%.
You're talking about the intubation one, too.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, is that important? The intubation one that we were just talking about a second ago. Because you have the external wound infection up on there, I think it's confusing people.
No, this is the side. This is where the discussion was. So you're right. This had the voting for the other one, but what you need to be looking at is the information that reflects the discussion.
Certainly if they keep it at 24 hours, I think we should get closer to 100%.
And that's not at issue. I mean, it is as specified, so that would remain.
Last week's last meeting we had, did we in fact move any measures? I don't recall moving any measure to inactive status. We did. How many? Remember?
There were not any that were recommended to move to inactive status. There was discussion of a few of them that could potentially be candidates for inactive status. But really, the inactive status, and actually I'm going to let Heidi speak to this if she's willing to do so, is a new approach that NCF is taking and is still working that through, but the draft guidance out at this point is that you might determine that a measure could be moved to an inactive status only on the condition that it is important to measure, it meets all of the criteria, but the performance is so high that you would not expect that there would be a huge opportunity cost to increase it beyond the performance level at the time.
Right. So I think what you'll want to look at is not only is it topped out at the top, you want to look at the variation. You also want to look at the disparities data, if they're able to provide it, because if you see, there's an issue with the disparities, you may very well determine that you don't want to use the inactive status here. The one caveat I will say is this status is going to the NQF board for their consideration because it does need to be approved since it is a new endorsement status that will happen next week. So if you do decide that you want to use this and it's appropriate for any of these measures, we will caveat it with if the board approves it. And then if they do not, then we will bring it back to you, and then we'll have to figure out what your next step will be. But again, we don't want to remove endorsement from measures that may be very appropriate to continue to surveil, to look at over perhaps a periodic time period. So this was our way of acknowledging that these are still evidence-based measures. They meet all the criteria, except they don't show any disparities. There's no variation, that type of thing.
So just to really clarify, measures that are really good measures that we're concerned providers potentially may not attend to any further if they come off of the active list. If they're still inactive, they would be easily reinstituted.
So at the deliberations next week, is NQF going to create a process for the committees, this one and others, to move measures to inactive status, which might include a number of steps that you would take to do that?
Right. So right now what we're thinking is anytime measures that come up for maintenance, because it would only be applicable to measures that are currently endorsed, it will be brought to the committee as a potential option. The other thing that we are building in is the ability to continue to capture the updated specifications on those measures, because if we do think it's important for periodic surveillance, that type of thing, we'll continue to have that on our website and available for individuals. So that's our preliminary thinking at the moment, whether that would mean more in the way of guidance to the steering committees. We're developing that now. And again, your discussion will help us with that. So we appreciate it.
So there is a broader context here that there's a lot of pressure at NQF and also on CMS and other venues to remove topped-out measures. That happened in the hospital value-based purchasing final rules in the last week or two, where there was pressure put on CMS to remove four or five of the measures, and they did so. So I guess I would say that we ought to be paying more attention to that and build it into the process. And I guess today and tomorrow, if we have the option, if there are measures that look to be topped out, then we have the option of sort of punting on them until there's clarification, correct?
Not sure what you meant by punting.
Well,
you had the opportunity.
Put it aside, not to vote. Got to take a vote this time.
Or what you have the opportunity to do is go ahead and vote. But you would vote. You would first make the determination that it remained important and it met all of the criteria. So you would go through all of that process, and then because of the level of performance, which is the only time a measure that is deemed to be important is going to have the opportunity to move to an inactive status, that you would recommend that occur contingent upon approval by the NQF board for that designation.
Thanks.
So the question for us with this measure, we voted on it, and that part's done, but the question is, do we want to recommend that it move to inactive status? Do we think that's passed out?
Well, one of the reasons that it might pop out is that the threshold's too generous. I mean, hopefully one learns from these. That's just what we're all about. What we're trying to do is change behavior. And if we have a threshold that is so generous that nobody's behavior is going to change, then putting on inactive status is not doing the justice to the reason we have it to begin with. So I would think that, and harken back to it, I think 24 hours is way too generous. And it's set up as a sort of a surrogate for other issues. For instance, if more of your patients require, or if a number of your patients require more than 24 hours, should maybe they have been operated on to begin with? I mean, that's one question. And secondly, to keep it at this because it might lead to premature extubation makes no sense to me at all. I mean, you extubate when you need to extubate, but the way it's set up, I don't think we're learning anything from this. And just putting it in active status doesn't get us where we need to be. It's sort of shuffling it under the rug. You need to have a threshold that actually delineates or discriminates between and helps people look at their behavior and make some change for it. And 24 hours for me just doesn't cut it. So that's where I am.
If I could comment on this one, we talked about this on the call. It's an interesting measure. And I would say that the reasons why patients are intubated for more than 24 hours after heart surgery are multifactorial. The one that's most obvious is to get at the anesthetic technique, and an anesthetic technique that results in prolonged somnolence and delayed extubation is probably not a good practice. But patients are also sometimes, say, intubated because of hemodynamic instability or hemorrhage. And the thinking, at least on the call that I was on, was that this might be augmented by an average time to extubation for non-outlier patients, which would be a good measure of the anesthetic approach and the approach to the care of the patient. And then the greater than 24 hours intubation would become more of a surrogate measure for the issues like hemodynamic instability or operating on the wrong patient, somebody who's already been on a ventilator for a month when they go to the operating room, for example. And having those two together might complement and solve some of the problems that we're concerned about with this measure.
As a group, we voted to endorse the measure. I hear what you're saying, Terry, about the fact that you'd like for the measure to be a better measure. In terms of whether we believe that it should, but we voted to endorse it as a group. Do we think that it is premature then to put it on inactive status?
Yeah, I really like David's approach to that way. At least it discriminates. You know, you learn something about the group who maybe should have been intubated earlier, and you learn something about the other group who were sicker and had complications. But lump them all together, I think, doesn't do service to either one of those groups. So maybe a message we can get back to SCS is to help us maybe craft another, if that's something we can recommend, to address that very issue that David brought up.
So then the recommendation is that this remain in an active status, that it be endorsed, and that SCS get a recommendation that they develop a companion measure. Okay.
That sounds good. Let's move on to, is there more?
Dave Sheehan from SGS. I came in late because I had travel problems this morning. Could I just ask for some clarification as to what you're looking for? I understand you're asking for a change in the measure, which I thought had been endorsed, so could I just ask for some specifics?
Asking for development of a companion measure. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think, David, not a change in the measure, but a companion measure that might get at the question of anesthetic and postoperative practice, such as a median time to extubation for those not intubated for greater than 24 hours. That's something in that mode, because there's a concern that this measure was described as a sloppy measure that allows for lax practice, that allows for patients who ought to routinely be extubated before 24 hours remaining intubated for a longer period of time than is appropriate.
So you're asking for a new additional measure. Thank you.
When does this measure come up for review again? In 3 years. So would it be a fair statement that the likelihood of this being passed 3 years from now, and certainly in its current status, is probably highly unlikely, given the concerns in that? Because what I'm trying to set up is a timeline or an expectation for the development of a new measure.
So your additional recommendation is that this companion measure be brought forward at the next time this is brought forward for maintenance review.
Okay, next measure, 130, risk-adjusted deep sternal wound infection rate. This condition is also around additional data regarding disparities. Let's go ahead and vote. Nineteen votes for yes, one abstain. Measure number 131, risk-adjusted stroke for vascular accident. And our conditions here were data regarding disparities, also the time period in which the cases were eligible for inclusion in the numerator, and exclusion of patients with a prior stroke. And SPS responded, and we consider that to be sufficient. Any other discussion of this? Let's go ahead and vote. Could everybody hit their button one more time? That's 20 votes for yes. The next measure is measure 300 that we spent some time talking about. We decided that the conditions were not entirely satisfying. Is that correct? Not entirely satisfied. We asked for more conditions. Let's move on to measure 1501, risk-adjusted operative mortality for mitral valve repair. So our conditions were that we wanted clarification whether this is simply open chest procedures. And the response was that it applies to all mitral valve repairs. And then we asked for data on disparities. Any discussion? Okay, let's vote. Please hit your buttons one more time. If there is somebody that consistently notices that after they hit their button, the vote is over, please come up and see us. Maybe there's battery change.
21 votes for yes, and no votes for no or abstain. The next measure is 1502, risk-adjusted operative mortality for mitral valve repair and coronary artery bypass graft surgery. Again, we voted for the data on disparities. Let's go ahead and vote. One votes for yes, none for no, or abstain. So we're done with that portion. And now it's time for us to move on to discussion of phase one related and competing measures and the steering committee recommendation for endorsement. It is, time to move on to that discussion. Was Alexis going to talk about this? Were you going to talk about this?
Yeah.
Okay.
So this activity is a new piece of work with NQF, and it's looking at, where we have a number of measures that are related and the extent to which those measures can be harmonized, assuming that they both are important or whatever number are important. And when you're looking at related measures, you're looking at they may have the same measure focus, they may have a different measure focus, but the same population or care setting. So they are not looking at the same focus and the same population. The relationship does not put them in competition one with the other. So the first question to answer while you're looking at the measures is, are they, in fact, truly, as you see them, related measures that should be looked at then further in terms of harmonization, where it is appropriate to harmonize, where there are unintended differences that could, in fact, lend themselves to harmonization. And then you're looking at whether or not the measures are competing. Are they, in fact, looking at the same measure focus and the same population such that you want to, or we should, be looking at whether or not we should have two measures that are looking at the same focus in the same population, and whether or not one of those measures is a best measure. This goes to the best in class question. So what we've got are a set of measures that you will look at in terms of here, what you see on the screen is the measure related to a database for cardiac surgery. This is measure 113 that you have evaluated in phase one. And a related measure is another STS measure looking at participation in a database for general thoracic surgery. And then the third measure is the one that Helen mentioned to the group when the group met in March in terms of the generic database. So those are the ones that you're now looking at in terms of related or competing measures. The threshold question that the group discussed at its in-person meeting was the question, and I think this was also discussed during the conference call, was the question about clearly and certainly at the time of initial endorsement of measures related to participation in databases. It was at a time whenever there were few measures, when there needed to be a mechanism through which information could be collected in order to learn about performance. And one of the issues that the group discussed is whether or not that time had gone by and whether or not the information that now provides data for measures that are drawn from a database supplant the need for a measure that says participation in a database. So there are two questions in Dr. Spina's not happy. He's concentrating. Okay. So you can address it either way. You can take the discussion of should there be measures around participation in a database, any database, and if the answer to that is yes, then it's probably good to go on to the next part of taking a look at these measures in terms of harmonization and competing measures.
One of the things that we're thinking about here that has come up in multiple conversations in the group was the precedent that this was set, because there are more and more databases being developed, regional databases, national databases, and there's more interest in looking at data in secondary databases for quality improvement and accountability. So we are not making a final decision here, but we are making some important preliminary decisions that likely will be discussed and revisited many times in the future. And there are a number of different ways to handle this. I think that the first question, as Melinda said, the first question that we should probably discuss is whether we think that participation in any sort of systematic database should be essentially mandated. So any sort of database should be mandated. Anybody want to open that up?
Well, I will tell you that your board certification in surgery now depends on you having some sort of database, you know, some sort of quality control of yourself. So you, it essentially forces you already to participate in a database.
Should we mandate the hospital participate in databases?
That's one. I was trying to remember the measures for cardiothoracic surgery. Are there any that do not include a requirement for comparing the performance against a database? Because that was one of the issues you brought up. Is this already included in the other individual measures? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think that they're all within the SCS database. Is that right? All of the measures were within the SGS database, and so one of the questions that arose was, is it appropriate for us to mandate that hospitals participate in the SGS database?
And I thought we had decided no, that it had to be some type of a database multi-hospital. So I thought that that was a change for those individual measures, that it could not dictate SGS database.
But I think what we got was clarification that the measures, while it's clear that they say the information for those measures that's presented in terms of performance was drawn from data in the FTS database, that participation in the FTS database was not a requirement of the measure.
Right.
And there was discussion around what might you then have to do in order to put that data together. But in none of those measures is, in the measures themselves, none of those require participation in the FCS database.
Do they require participation
in a database? And we're talking now about the measures with using data derived from the database. We're not talking about these measures. So say your question.
Well, I'm just wondering, is it duplicative to have a measure that just calls for participation in a database if the individual measures for performance include in the measurement of that measure the necessity to be participating in a database? So by nature, if you are submitting information on those measures, you must be already participating in a database. Does that make sense? in which case we wouldn't need any of these, because anyone submitting a cardiographic measure would be participating in the database.
And that's the threshold question. The issue, though, is that they would not necessarily be participating
right.
in the STS database,
right.
but they would have to be able to derive, to collect, and have all of the information for computing the performance against the measure.
I think also saying you're participating in the database makes you have to compare yourself to others,
yeah.
as opposed to just creating your own database. So I think it is a separate issue.
That's the same point I was going to make. There's a real utility in participating in a national registry where you can benchmark against other people, and so rather than just having the homegrown registry.
Yeah, but I agree with Christine that if we are to focus just on the particular measures, by that happening, people are going to have to participate in a database. They will have to be comparing themselves because our measures will require that, particularly as they evolve in their complexity. I'm not sure that we have to say, it's mandatory that you have to participate in a database. We're going to say you have to submit these measures. How you get these measures and how you wish to compare yourselves to others as required by the measure is up to the, should be up to the institution. But otherwise, how many databases, where does it stop? How many databases do we tell
people? But are the measures actually saying that you have to compare yourself? I don't think they're actually saying that. They are saying that you need to collect this data, but it's not really saying that you have to compare yourself.
I would kind of err on the side of being explicit rather than implicit in the registry. I know what you're saying, Peter, but it's possible people can interpret it in a way where they don't participate in a national registry. So I'd rather be explicit about it.
What's the burden of that? This measure on providers, on collection of the data, on anything, is a yes or no question, essentially.
Well, if there's a history here that Dr. Sheehan may want to comment on as well. So the STS database is overwhelmingly the most ubiquitous benchmark database in the country for cardiac surgery. But there are two very important other databases that are highly respected, the Northern New England database, which was a spontaneous effort among New England hospitals, and then the mandatory New York State reporting system, both of which have had a long life and have been very effective. And they used all the same concepts, and the comorbidities and the outcomes overlap but are non-identical. And certainly everyone involved in the STS database would acknowledge that institutions in New York State that are in the New York State database and from a mandatory requirement by New York State government, or those that are voluntarily in the NME are doing a good job of doing benchmark quality assurance. And so that's why this language, I think, ought to be ambiguous, that it's in a data set where you are benchmarking against other institutions. David, do you have anything to add to what?
No, I think you've covered it correctly. We are now at about 95% participation nationally. The only programs that don't participate are basically those in Northern New England or New York. When the measures were initially adopted, we were well below that level, and this was an attempt using a structural measure of quality to drive participation in a national registry. For all practical purposes, given the pressure to report the hard outcomes that we now report, you are correct that it would act, de facto, you must belong in a systematic cardiac surgery registry, or you basically can't exist in cardiac surgery in the United States today. Now, having said that, that's not true for the general thoracic, where I would say a large percentage of general thoracic surgery in this country is conducted in programs where there is no participation in a systematic database. So the measure for cardiac surgery, do what you feel is correct. I don't think it's going to change the status quo because we're at a point in cardiac surgery right now where you can't survive without being in a registry.
If I could just make one other comment on this, the requirement presupposes the existence of an effective organization to do the data analysis and benchmarking, and requiring institutions to participate in an organization that doesn't do that effectively is probably not a wise thing to do.
To your question about what is the cost to the hospital or provider?
I have a question maybe for the FCS representative about, isn't there a requirement for to get reimbursement to participate in FCS at this point for a lot of the payers?
Many payers do actually require this, either for participation in their plan, certainly for premium status of various sorts. So yes, that is correct. And did somebody want to ask about the cost of participation? Was that a question? Yeah,
the burden and cost,
certainly. The average cost to a participant, and a participant is typically either a hospital or a large surgical group, the cost is approximately $3,000 a year. On top of that, you have software costs, which range anywhere from about $10,000 for a very, very good program, anywhere into the hundreds of thousands for all the bells and whistles, but you can do it for about $10,000 software costs. The major cost, as in all registries, is the cost of data collection. And we estimate one FTE for every 500 cases entered.
I mean, that is a major issue that was brought up at my institution. We participate in getting to what Peter was saying is, you know, how many do you do? We have four full-time abstractors for the FCS database at the Rochester campus. We have abstractors in Florida and Arizona, and basically the decision in Florida was we're also paying for an abstractor for NISQIP. The multi-specialty NISQIP came out, so we're going to stop participating in FCS. We're going to use the cardiac surgery NISQIP. So there is this dynamic, as we had mentioned multiple times, you know, burden of data abstraction and participation in different databases, and the cost is, the cost to actually, you know, submit the data is relatively mild. Is in medical terms, $10,000 maybe. But trained abstractors can, full-time FTE can run into the, you know, multiple tens of thousands, if not with benefits and everything, and $100,000 a year. And so you have to get some real value out of it. And if they can do 15 cardiac cases for the NISQIP sample as opposed to doing 40 FCS ones, because they have to have requirements to all, I believe, in FCS, and I'm not 100%. People are making their cost-benefit thing. It's a huge number, and as it becomes more and more burdensome, it's going to become more and more of an issue.
To get back to the fundamental question, I think there is value to participating in a registry above and beyond simply counting your cardiac mortality or anything else, and for less evolved specialties than cardiac surgery, there's a much more primitive point that David mentioned of having very low participation in national or aggregate benchmarking.
This sort of gets back to what Dr. Halpern was saying, and that is that participating in a registry means that you are comparing yourself to other hospitals, and that's kind of the bottom line for whereas the other measures that we voted on just mean that you're measuring those items. So do we believe that we want to advocate for essentially endorsing that hospitals belong to a registry where they're comparing themselves to other hospitals?
Yeah, I think we've had the, you know, discussion before that I think everybody's on the same page and that registry participation makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think most hospitals realize that, yes, there are going to be resources that need to be put towards this end. The difficulty has to do with multiple similar, mm-hmm. quote, competing sources. And obviously, if you've got multiple, if you're participating in multiple registries, you're diluting resources that could be better spent towards, you know, in different areas.
Okay.
And we...
Sorry. So the decision here, I think, is are these measures competing? Are they related? If they're related, should they be harmonized? So competing versus related is a decision that we have to make here.
I'm sorry, I just have one other comment or question. If we move towards a mandate, which it sounds like we're inching towards, that normally carries with it some sense of authority or jurisdiction, i.e. punishment if you don't belong, and I'm not sure that we actually own that kind of...
And I don't think that's what it's trying to do, and that's not what this question is trying to go to.
Right.
The threshold question is, does endorsement continue for a measure that speaks to participation in a database?
Oh, okay. Because I heard the mandate word two or three times, and I just want to... Right.
I think that this question is trying to go there, but we don't necessarily have to help.
Okay.
Yeah. A question that arises, though, from this, though, is what I remember the discussion was with SPS last time was, yes, it comes from the SPS database, the data to support that there's a performance gap and whatever, and that there's also, these are our measures. But then the question became, and then they said, well, it's all on the web. People can go to our website and download the way of doing so that you get the number, the risk-adjusted number. Is basically saying, if we endorse a measure designed that way, yes, you don't have to participate in FTS, but you have to follow FTS's rules in how they adjust their risk adjustment for whatever it is. That's where I fundamentally had the problem last time, was because what if there is a different risk adjustment model used by a different nationally qualified data, the clinical database registry? Should we say, all right, you can participate in that one, but for this specific measure, you have to use the rules and the methodology outlined by the FTS that we've endorsed, even though you participate in this measure. You participate in a nationally qualified clinical data set that comes up with, that evaluates cardiac surgery, but just doesn't happen to use the same methodology. You still have to use that methodology. That's where you get into the problem. If you're going to say we need to harmonize, then you have to harmonize the measures and say that the methodology for the measurement is identical or standard so that you don't have to use the FTS methodology. Well, risk adjustment is very important in cardiac surgery. They have a different risk adjustment than maybe NISQIP has. So we're saying, yes, you can go to the web and do it, but what that means is I've got a person in my hospital that's got to do the NISQIP data set, and then I have to take our raw data, I have to go to the FTS data set, I have to get their methodology, I have to redo it, then submit it to you. That's a data burden. And that's what we have to clarify here. Is are we saying you participate in a data set, and then the measures that could become from STS, but they can't use the STS risk adjustment, because that means, in essence, you have to do what they're doing. That's picking a winner.
I agree with that point, although there is some benefit to homogenous reporting of data across all these data sets. And if these are the best minds in the field, in the NISQIP and the FTS, if there are differences in their models, maybe an appropriate thing is to have them come with their measures and debate that, why one's better than the other, when they're putting their measures forward.
But then, either way,
you're going to, if I say at the end of that debate, A wins versus B, then you have to say, we're letting you participate in a database. You say that's fine for that measure, but at the end of the day, that data really doesn't count. You have to use somebody else's. You have to use their methodology. What's the purpose of doing that then? Then you're saying, well, then why are you paying for this? You should just do that.
Well, I just say, I think you can agree with one of the developers that their model is stronger, and that's, I think, an appropriate thing for us to do, to have data nationally be collected in a similar way and be comparable.
I think what... If I get you right, what you're trying to say is if one database has a better model, then all databases should move towards that model.
Yeah.
I think that's a different discussion, though, than measurement development. We're being asked to develop a mortality
you know, risk-adjusted mortality for aortic valve replacement, ABR, you know, 120. And although it's based on FCS risk adjustment methodology, so if you use your NISQIP to report your risk-adjusted operative mortality for mitral valves, is that sufficient, or do you have to say, I collected that data, I've done it, and now I have to go back and use the free, publicly accessible data methodology on the FCS website to reprocess my data and readminister and then resubmit it? That's what I'm saying, there's a difference.
Okay, Dr. Seema, thank you. I think that I agree that that's sort of a nuance for discussion about whether other databases should move toward one best model. And we talked about those nuances as well previously, but that is sort of outside of what we're trying to accomplish for right now. Dr. Sheehan, did you have something to add?
Yeah, just a point of fact. I've served as an advisor to NISQIP for the last 4 years. I serve on their measurement committee, their policy advisory committee. There is no NISQIP cardiac surgery model. There is no competing model. I work very closely with Cliff Coe, who directs it. We work in a complementary fashion. They have no desire to get into cardiac surgery. They do not have a cardiac surgery module. They do not plan a cardiac surgery model. So, and feel free to call them anytime to check on that.
Well, Alan and I sit on the Joint Commission NISQIP board, and based in the multi-specialty, there's cardiac surgery in it.
There's also prostatectomy and laminectomy and neurosurgery. These are not models designed for cardiac surgery. These are generic risk models. They were never intended to be used for something as specialized as this. And they're actually phasing out that model as they bring in specialty-specific models in general surgery, but they have no plans to do so for cardiac surgery.
But right now, they're reporting on that. You can participate in the multi-specialty and have cardiac surgery patients included in that.
But you can include anybody you want, but the risk models are so generic, they'd be, in our opinion, little value.
That actually comes with a vascular, too, because I've noticed that in NISQIP, predicted mortality in certain cases, like, for instance, an infected aortic graft, their predicted mortality of the patient that was involved was 2%, which is ridiculous.
But I'm not supporting one or the other, but I'm just saying, as Dr. Sheehan just pointed out, it's in his opinion and the FCS opinion, it's not any good. But we're asking whether or not participating in a national database, systematic database, is appropriate. And that's the question at hand here, not whether or not one is better than the other. So there is a national clinically recognized database that does have cardiac surgery data in it. Whether you agree with the modeling or not is a different question. My point is this. Should a hospital then also need to participate in FCS, or can they use the cardiac, fulfill the requirement for cardiac surgical patients if they participate in NISQIP?
The question begs credulity. Nobody is using NISQIP for cardiac surgery. It was not designed for cardiac surgery. You may choose to use it, but you will be alone, essentially, in the country. I can't say anything else. Matter of fact.
Just as kind of a historical point, NISQIP went to a high-risk model just to look at certain cases, and that is being phased out, but they are going to come up with surgery-specific models. And I agree right now, I guess there's not a plan to do something around cardiac, but I don't think it precludes that they will. But in just reading the measure and talking here, it seems fairly agnostic. It doesn't say that it has to be STS. Am I reading that correctly? So I think the main point all of us want to have here is that we do believe it ought to be collected. We believe it ought to be benchmarked. It ought to be risk-adjusted. Does it have to be STS? I think that's the only question that's out there, because STS seems to have the preponderance of the hospitals, but there can be other data sets that come up. So I think, from my sense, I'm fine with it as long as it's not exclusionary to just STS.
But doesn't it become focused? Aren't we then directing it if we approve this because of the stewardship?
I don't know.
Yeah.
That's a good question. I don't know.
Isn't the question at hand is whether these are competing
measures, I mean, these have all been approved. We're not asking whether to approve these or not, whether these are competing, and in that competing make us have to select one versus the other. And I would suggest that these are not competing, that these are related, that they're different patient populations. Obviously, the measure on the right is a much more generic measure for a hospital, and every hospital can meet that in a variety of ways, and that these are not, as listed there, competing and really have nothing to do with a lot of the discussion that's been which database is actually used. And so I would suggest that unless someone thinks that they're competing, we should discuss that we call these related and move on with that.
Does everybody agree to call these related rather than competing? Dr. Seamus, do you agree? So yeah. Another issue that we have here then is since 113 is maintenance measure, and Dr. Shahan said that there's more than 95% participation, and that if you don't participate, essentially you're alone, should this become an inactive measure?
Yes, I think I suggested that last time. I think in many, many specialties and disciplines, this is a very important measure. I mean, the number of anesthesia practices reporting anesthesia data is less than 5% right now. So there's a huge opportunity in other specialties. But in this case, they've topped it out.
Anybody else?
I was just kind of, I think that's a good point, because isn't part of the intention that these measures will be publicly reported and the public can make judgments about quality based on the result of measures? So in a simple way, a lot of people would get credit for quality in the public's eye when it may actually be the status quo.
Any other thoughts on 113 and whether we would recommend that it go to an inactive status?
Another perspective on this would be that rate is 95%, which means that 5% aren't participating, and do you want to draw attention to that 5%? Is that an issue? Because it's not the rate that's reported, it's the individual facility or practice. Does this hospital participate in the registry? Not that the rate is 95%.
Do we know what the number is combined for all of the databases that are out there? So if it's 95% for FGS, how much of that 5% gap, how much of that are those that belong to the New England Consortium and the New York State databases?
So with the language of the measure, they would still be adherent to the measure.
It sounded like from the FGS representative, the compliance is about 100% if you include the New England database and the New York, from what he was saying earlier.
Does anybody disagree with recommending that this move to inactive status? Okay.
So then what we can do is vote for retaining endorsement with the caveat that it would be on inactive status if the board of directors approves that, the status.
Can I ask what that means practically? Is it like double secret probation when you go to inactive? What does that mean?
It means that it would be set with measures that would not be expected to be monitored and reported on, because remember this is a public reporting piece, on the same frequency, but that it could be brought back into an active status and then reported upon without having to go through all of the process.
When you say not with the same frequency, does that mean they still get monitored at some frequency?
It's voluntary, and there is the expectation that there would be some monitoring of it, but periodically there would not be an expectation on the part of NQF to have, unless the board of directors specifies something, to have a specific interval during which it's reported upon.
Right. This is where it gets challenging, because we don't control the implementation. We're not necessarily involved in the implementation and the reporting of these measures. So anything that does go into an active status, in the same way as anything that's endorsed, we don't, other than us saying this meets our criteria, that is an influencer on who implements and uses these measures, but beyond that, we can't say with all certainty that any measure that's endorsed will be used and reported. So inactive in that way, I think that's something that the committee needs to balance as well, is when you do have a measure that moves into inactive, you're sending a message, still valid, still reliable, still important, popped out, that may actually move a measure off of implementation programs. And I think that's part of what you need to look at is what are the unintended consequences of that. With this measure, I don't think that's an issue. You may have a few coming forward that you would need to address that. But.
Well, I have a question. When a measure is moved to inactive status, is there some rationale then provided so that when people go there, they see the reason that we're putting it inactive is because there's 95% to near 100 if you include all of them, so that they know we're not saying this is not important anymore?
So this is part of the messaging that we're still figuring out because we're new to the maintenance piece of this. We want to be able to message when removal of endorsement occurs, what was that reason? We want to be able to say why it moved into an active status. So we're currently figuring out what is that, what's the level of detail. But again, inactive would clearly state it meets all the criteria except it's topped out.
So if you're still working on the language, should we even be talking about this at this point? Because you're now asking us to discuss and vote on something that may change. And we just spent a whole lot of time talking about this. And so if we don't know what the message is going to be based on our vote, then it really doesn't seem like the right thing to do at this time.
So can I respond? We provided information about inactive status in terms of the draft, and that is one of the reasons why you would caveat a decision. But within the information about inactive status, it provides for the fact that the measure focus continues to be important, that it meets the criteria based on evidence of scientific acceptability, usability, feasibility, and that the only issue is that it is topped out. So that part of the criteria, I don't think, is at issue or would be expected to be changed by the board.
Right. I mean, we put the inactive status proposal out for comment and received comment from the membership. In general, it's supportive. I don't anticipate that the board will have an issue with it. So in that way, we feel that it's probably in the best interest of your time to at least consider it now rather than have you come back on a conference call and do it. But we are taking, you know, a bit of a chance asking you to do this. We're also doing it with another committee as well. With the language, though, on the website, let me be clear, all your documents that go out for comment and report in the report will clearly explain what you have proposed and what your recommendation is. Nothing else on the website will change. The measures stay endorsed until this final review is done. It goes through the Consensus Standards Approval Committee, and then it goes to the board. That gives us until November or so to figure out the language that actually goes on the website with these measures that are inactive. So I think we're okay. I mean, from a staff perspective, we feel comfortable. And so the question is if you all feel comfortable having that conversation today, but we don't think that there will be an issue going to the board.
Can I ask a question? I'm just curious what our Dr. Sheen has to say about will this have impact on anything going on in cardiac surgery if we go to making this measure inactive?
No, I don't think this will have any impact because the measures derived from database participation are essentially required if you want to have a cardiac surgery program. The only thing I would worry about was the comment that was made, what's the message we're sending? I am a little concerned about that. But I leave that to your good judgment. But
success.
I think
that's the message. You've done it. You've got everybody.
Well, as long as everybody as long as the rest of the world understands that, I think it's all in how it's presented.
It is an invitation inactive to successful.
we've had, I can't say how many, high achievement, emeritus, we don't know the right name. Any suggestions are welcome.
I have a question. On these inactive states and for measures that are topped out, is there a concern with regression? High rates of compliance, 95 plus, it's not such a big deal here, but I see measures we'll talk about in the future where I think it is, where if you go back to 90, 80%, you know, some even lower rates, that's a real concern. Have there been similar scenarios where things have been moved to inactive, the committee's determined it's topped out, and then you've seen a regression?
Well, I know this is not really up for discussion at this point, but it would be very interesting as this gets developed by the staff that perhaps there's a infrequent reporting component built in, and again, maybe for this one it doesn't need to be as frequent, but for some of the other ones, again, that are coming up today, something that looks at it on an annual basis or, you know, whatever frequency seems reasonable so that it's inactive, but still there's some feedback loop so that if it's slipping, we would know about that.
They're all really good points. Those things that we've been trying to figure out because no one knows what the potential impact of this is. So this is, again, where we need to balance because we do not control who implements, reports out all of this. That's not within NQF's purview. But what we, as we move toward electronic systems, we're hoping that this actually can be much easier, especially with some of these measures. I think once you have an electronic system, you'll be able to pull this and be able to surveil it periodically. But it's one of those things we honestly don't know the answer to yet. And we'll have to continue to monitor with it, work with CMS, HHS, and others to figure out what we can do to assist.
Okay. So we essentially agreed as a group that if there's an inactive or emeritus or some other label for measure 113, we agree that it should go there. We should move on to measure 134, which is going to
be... We should vote.
Did we already vote?
Right.
Do we need to officially vote? Oh, okay. We're going to officially vote. Do you recommend this measure for endorsement?
And the caveat here is that it will also say and move to inactive status.
We're recommending it for move to inactive status.
As an endorsed measure.
So endorsement does not preclude inactive. In fact, it has to be endorsed to move to inactive. Please hit your button again. That's 20 votes for yes and 1 abstain. The next measure is 134. Surgery patients who receive appropriate venous thromboembolism prophylaxis within 24 hours prior to surgery to 24 hours after surgery end time. And again, this is we're going to see measures that are potentially related versus competing here. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I misread that? I'm sorry. I'm getting ahead of myself. I apologize. Coronary artery bypass graft using internal mammary artery, 134.
Why does SCS have two of these measures? What's the difference?
That's what we're supposed to be talking about here.
I think the difference is simply is mainly the exclusions and 134. And actually, what you have in your what you probably have in your paperwork, our staff discovered a slight error, which I hope will be corrected. But the appropriate exclusions list should not include the IMA is not a suitable conduit. When this was discussed recently on a call, we agreed to eliminate that exclusion. So the exclusions that are considered valid are subclavian stenosis, previous cardiothoracic surgery, mediastinal radiation, emergent or salvage procedure, or the absence of LAD disease. So again, the it's mainly the exclusions, and I think 134 is the measure that is being put forward.
The endorsed measure 0516 was endorsed 4 years ago. Wouldn't that be up for review again by now if it's 4 years old? I was confused by the date on that.
This is Jay Han from STS. May I answer that question? Measure 516 is actually, it was first introduced in 2008 and it was received time-limited endorsement. And so I know how you bought things, and you probably speak from the interim perspective, but it was reviewed by the CSAC last July 2010, and received final endorsement or full endorsement as a result of that discussion. The reason why, is, as Dr. Shaheen explained, the exclusions are listed differently, which we will have corrected, but the other difference is that 516 is at the physician level, while 134 is at the hospital or facility level. I don't think we have any problems combining them into a single one. The reason why we have a physician level measure is for PQRI. So I don't know what happened in 2008. It was before I started here, but I think it was submitted as a separate measure with the same specifications just for that reason.
Would the group, that make sense? Or? Yes, thank you. Would the group like to recommend that they be harmonized? Okay. Anything else? Dr. Shaheen, do you want to say anything?
We would not vote on the measure as it exists today because you've just recommended that it be harmonized, so you'd be voting on something that's going to be overtaken very quickly.
Okay. Next measure, 218. Now we're going to talk about surgery patients who received appropriate venous thromboembolism prophylaxis within 24 hours prior to surgery to 24 hours after surgery end time.
So I can make a couple comments because I looked at this. We've been through one of these measures, the 218 last time, and we voted to endorse that. That's specific to selected surgical patients, and there's a list of diagnoses that apply in their measure. The other measure, the previously endorsed measure from the Joint Commission, is medical and surgical patients, essentially all patients over the age of 18, as I read it. So it's a much broader inclusion criteria, and the 218 is a subset of the patients included in 371. So that's one difference. The other difference is what is considered VTE prophylaxis, and in my understanding, the 371 measure includes any documented VTE prophylaxis measure or technique, medication or mechanical prophylaxis, versus the 218, which requires really the chest position guideline measures primarily as to meet the criteria. So the 371 is not restricted to any one individual set of guidelines. There are competing guidelines, chest positions, which is based on DVT prophylaxis. There's one from the orthopedic surgery group, which is based on symptomatic PE, which differ from the AC, the chest position guidelines. So those are some of the differences. It's a smaller, it's a subset of the bigger group, and it's a more specified degree of what is acceptable prophylaxis. There is some controversy over what is acceptable prophylaxis, and that those two groups have not been able to work out a mutually standardized prophylaxis guidelines. So they're sort of competing guidelines at this point.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think some of the controversy arises from bleeding versus clotting risks.
Correct.
The risk of bleeding into recently surgical spaces and the detrimental effects of that.
Yeah, yep. This is Dale Bratzler. I need to correct something here. I was the chair of the technical expert panel for the NQF Joint Commission BTE measures that are being discussed here, the competing measure. The surgical population is explicitly excluded from that measure. That measure focuses only on medical patients. So this measure focuses on surgical patients based on the ACCP guidelines, which give procedure-specific level one recommendations for VPE prophylaxis. The populations do not overlap with the Joint Commission measure. We worked carefully to make sure that they did not overlap. And the reason that the NQF endorsed the Joint Commission VTE measure allows any forms of prophylaxis is because for medical patients there are almost no guidelines that are explicit about which forms of VTE prophylaxis are appropriate for medical patients. So I chaired that technical expert panel and know the Joint Commission measures very well, and I can tell you without question that the SCIP population is excluded from those measures.
Bill, we're sitting here looking at Measure 371, which is the Joint Commission measure, and it includes surgical patients, both in the numerator as well as the denominator. It says medical and surgical inpatient discharges. If surgery incision time is greater than 24 hours of admission, patients must have documentation of prophylaxis within 24 hours of hospital admission. That's the measure that was endorsed in May of 2008.
And I'm telling you that if you look at the denominator specifications, the SCIP population is excluded.
Well, in our document, it says denominator, all patients.
Right. That's correct.
Well, I can tell you that if you look at the ICD-9 codes, the SCIP population, we worked carefully to make sure that the two measures did not completely overlap, so that they don't overlap. The SCIP population is not included in the Joint Commission measure.
Yeah, on page 22, it does list SCIP as an exclusion.
So then why would...
And the reason is that there are a large number of surgical patients that don't fall under the SCIP population for which there aren't explicit recommendations around MVT, prophylaxis, or others. They're hospitalized, they may have some surgery, but the SCIP population, the SCIP measure that you're discussing now, only reflects those operations for which there are published level 1A recommendations for MVT, prophylaxis. And that's the big difference between the Joint Commission and the CMS measure. The Joint Commission measure looked essentially at hospitalized patients. Did they get prophylaxis or did they have documentation of a reason to not get prophylaxis, whether they're medical or surgical? But the SCIP population is excluded from the Joint Commission measure.
Perhaps even more of a point to harmonize these, because I would say that most hospitals and most surgeons are doing this for all of their patients, whether they're in the SCIP population or not.
So, I understand that point, and you know, perhaps there's a way to do it. But the difference here is that we look at the appropriateness of prophylaxis based on surgical procedure in the SCIP population, whereas the Joint Commission measure only looks at whether any form of prophylaxis was given at all. And, you know, there just aren't many people out there that would recommend TENTOS for hip replacement surgery or other things, and that's the big difference in the specifications of the measures. The Joint Commission measure does not look at appropriateness, and that's the big difference for the SCIP measure. It looks at appropriateness.
So measure 218 is really for the SCIP population, it sounds like, whereas the other measure specifically excludes the SCIP population. Jim, I want to hear what you have to say, so I'm not trying to push us ahead, but we'll need to decide whether we want to endorse 218 and then request harmonization from the other measure.
What I was going to say, I think I understand that better with Dale's clarification, because I don't think we have all the details in what we were presenting. And it's, the Joint Commission makes it particularly hard to follow their algorithms. If you ever look at those, you just give up pretty quickly. So some of the tables are a little hard to find. So I think that clarification is helpful, and perhaps they are not the same group of patients. They're really more related. I guess having different criteria for different groups of patients for data collection extraction does complicate that process, and if there is an opportunity for harmonization, that would be an advantage. You do lose potentially some of the appropriateness, as we've discussed before. We did endorse that, but there is controversy, and guidelines do change with time. So, there may be an opportunity for harmonization here.
I just want to comment, having had the pleasure of just re-reviewing the CHEST guidelines. It's a very thick tome, and part of the reason is it's not a simple algorithm and subset of patients in whom there are data to make more specific recommendations exist, but there are also large groups of patients where we really are working in the realm of generalities. So, I can understand the concept that where the data exists to be more prescriptive about types of VTE prophylaxis. Even the CHEST guidelines are, their menus given for each of these categories, not a single treatment. It may make sense where there's data, yes, to be more prescriptive, and where there's not data, to simply be more general in terms of recommending some type in terms of in the absence of more definitive data.
Yeah, so I think you've highlighted why there are two separate measures. And again, I chaired the panel for the Joint Commission, and that's really the population. We're focused on the hospitalized population, medical patients, surgical patients that don't fall under the SCIP population. A hospital can pass with any form of prophylaxis or documentation of a reason not to use prophylaxis. The SCIP measures are very procedure-specific. In the development of the denominator, we went through every ICD-9 code, now ICD-10 code, to define which patients would fall into the population of the denominator for each type of surgery. And then the menu that you mentioned from the CHEST guidelines, is the appropriate menu that's used to put the patient in the denominator for each type of surgery.
Okay. Thank you. Are we ready to vote on whether to endorse 218? Anybody want to say anything else about it? All right, let's go ahead and vote. Be sure you aim at Jessica. Please press your buttons one more time. Okay. 17 votes for yes, 2 votes for no, 1 abstain. Our next decision is whether we want to request that this be other measure be harmonized with this measure. Are we actually voting on that or just discussing?
We're not voting.
Okay.
But it would be a recommendation from the
surgery. It sounds like that's a no, since they're defined by different populations, and the reason they're defined as different populations is that the standards are different or the guidelines are different.
In that case, what I'd like to request is just that this be clarified a little bit more when it comes back up for review, that the populations are actually different. Jim, did you have anything to add? Next measure is measure 360, esophageal resection mortality rate, risk adjusted. And this was to be evaluated with 361, right?
So this is looking at the 360 and 361 mortality and volume in comparison to the leapfrog measure, which combines the two into a single measure. And the question here is not whether it competes, but rather is there an opportunity to take 360 and 361 and in some way through combining them or otherwise harmonizing with the leapfrog measure. And it was endorsed just in last September.
One of the issues that came up in our discussion of this was that volume is more predictive of mortality than mortality is, because the volume can be so low in some centers. So that should be part of our discussion here.
Go ahead and have a discussion, whatever they want to do, and then we can vote.
All right. So I guess what we should really discuss here is, do we want studies to be harmonized before we actually vote on them? Anybody disagree with that?
I think there's reasons not to harmonize. I mean, for the point you just raised of volume being an important measure. And if you look at the leapfrog measure, as best as I can figure out from the details that are here, it's all a calculation. And so you have no direct measurement. You're not quite sure what you're getting. All you get is the bottom line. And if mortality is less predictive than volume, I like seeing the numbers rather than just seeing a calculation.
Anybody else want to respond to that? I think that mortality has a lot of street credibility, and therefore it's important in that way. It probably should be measured. If it's measured as a completely separate entity, that can be deceptive. Is it possible to have a volume measure and then to have a mortality measure that is harmonized with volume as a separate? Can we make that recommendation? What do you guys think about making that recommendation?
And the recommendation there being to harmonize 360 and 361 to keep them separate from the leapfrog measure, I think that has a lot of credibility to do that.
This is Heidi. I mean, one option is to recommend that they be paired, which means that they're endorsed as two separate measures but should be implemented and used together, which is, I think, what you're trying to, where you're headed with those two.
And when they were initially endorsed, they were endorsed to be reported as pairs.
So I think you just want to continue that endorsement.
Any other discussion of this? Carol, do you feel satisfied by that?
That would sound good to me.
Okay. All right, let's go ahead and vote. Please aim your handheld at Jessica and vote one more time.
Beg your pardon?
Okay, that's 20 votes for yes. No no's and no abstains. I think what we're going to do now is it's 11:19. Yes, we'll take a break. Maybe is 5 minutes too short? 10-minute break. Then we'll come back in. Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I thought that we.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I'm sorry about that.
This is what having no eyes in the back of my head leads to. 361, let's go ahead and vote. Please just go ahead and vote twice. That's 20 votes for yes, no no's, and no abstains. Now a 10-minute break, assuming nothing else pops up behind me. So we'll see you back here at 11:30.
We need to have a break, but we need to have a conversation. Just because this is new. What Ty and I were just talking about is the thing that the group is about, and we still should come back to, is whether or not they are competing, whether or not the leapfrog measure competes with the 350 and 361, and whether or not the group would consider whether or not they were competing in the sense that the leapfrog measure is what 350 and 361. That's specific to that. That here's the part. Here's what I think we're kind of learning in this first discussion of relational competing is that I don't think the group is totally comfortable that they understand all of the differences
between a related versus a competing.
I think they get that.
Okay.
I don't think they feel that they have all the information about the measures themselves. I mean, what we're putting up here is the summary information of each of those specifications, but I'm kind of wondering if they feel that they would be, that they could do a better job if they looked at the whole measure.
Yeah.
Evaluation.
I mean, for some of this, we can give it to them. Some of them we don't have updated. We have out of date.
Right.
The survival predictors, we can give you updated information.
And they've done 361. So this one they could take sort of under advisement and let's have the conversation at
right.
the next.
We can, yeah. What it will come down to is when this goes forward, the question that will be asked, and you should get asked by the CSAC and everyone else, is whether or not the two ARC measures continue to be important enough to continue to endorse, or is the leapfrog measure a better measure? The only thing you can't do is that you can make a statement and say you still think the ARC measures have value because they use risk adjustment, they use a different data source, for whatever reasons you say. Or you can say the leapfrog measure actually is better and a superior measure, and then remove the noise and the issue. So that's the question that will come up when they go out for comment and for vote. And so I think we need to have a conversation.
Do you know the truth about what we actually...
Yeah.
What are the things that we are competing with?
Yeah. I mean, to me, they are competing. They approach it differently, but they both... One combines volume and mortality together. The other one has a separate... But they measure the same thing. Just one is risk adjustment and the other is using a different methodology. So I think we need to have that conversation. And what may be said today, though, is we haven't given the information that you all need to have that conversation. And that's fine. And we can pull that together and get that.
Can we wait to get that? Can we postpone that conversation to a follow-up telephone meeting? We're going to be discussing this
regardless. Yeah.
All right, we'll discuss the competing measures in phase two. Related or competing measures in phase two.
Mm-hmm.
Can we postpone this and just get the information to people and then have the telephone conversation rather than sort of walking around that day and then all deciding that we need more information?
The other point on that would be the only real way to answer that question rationally is to actually look at the results of measuring the same institution offering the same experience and looking at the performance of the two measures.
Right.
And my guess is that information doesn't exist.
We will never have that.
But we do when, like, comparing ARC measures to SPS measures. There's lots of literature on that and heart surgery. But comparing competing administrative data sets, nobody's ever taken the trouble to do it, and a lot of them have black boxes and things like that. So otherwise, you're just looking at the technical validity of the exercise. And
I mean, that's the challenge we're facing.
Yeah.
So, and that's, in a perfect world, we would be able to run it and be able to do it. We can't. So, but we need you all to run through the questions and the discussion and compare the evaluations of the two, you know, or if you can, at least review what's available on the existing endorsed measure, so we can struggle with the ones that are up for maintenance and your evaluation, and determine whether you feel that one is superior to the other. Because, especially with this will come up, because this was one of, I don't know if you know that history science or leapfrog predictors, but these went to the board, they went through the think tank, they went through the board, and we hit a wall where we didn't have enough information and data to know whether they were truly better measures or equivalent or whatever. So they ran data, they went through it, and then there were 3 of 7 that came back, and they were determined to actually produce similar or better results. And this is one of them. That's why we have to have the conversation. I think we just need to figure out what we need to pull together for you all to have it.
Yeah. Do you think that the measure evaluation forms would have all of the measure evaluation forms
for these 3 measures? That they could do it to the extent that it could be done, because that's all of the detail that's provided by the developer.
You mean today or
no,
on telephone?
No.
I think,
well, you know, this is the conversation that we had at 7:30 this morning. That this is learning. It's a new experience. And we already knew we were going to defer on the last part.
Right. And I think it's good to start out like you are, which is this is the competing versus the related measure. Because that's the question.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sometimes it's hard to say that.
Mm-hmm.
These, I think, I would call them. Truly.
And you know, something that you bring to it.
We're talking about the faculty.
Okay, I just wanted to let you know I'm
representing
Art. I'm not sure. Is John been on the phone?
John is here.
Oh,
I didn't know he was going to be here.
Oh, no worries.
No, anything else? No, I thought he was on the phone too.
So he wasn't going to be
open now? No, he hasn't been.
You'll do the introduction of the measure.
Okay.
So for the 110 one,
yep,
you're going to speak to it right now.
So you want us to speak to it now.
Okay.
Right. Well, wait, and then we can go. Should we put that one half an hour early?
I don't want to. I know, and I'd be more comfortable to tell you right now. Right now, it's like we're running behind.
Right.
So you wouldn't have to come back.
Okay.
But I don't know
that there are weekends. Can I give you Heidi Klein? Nice to meet you. Yeah.
I was going to ask you, do you know what the definition of that
That was very nice.
You were great. I got the message from Heidi. This is why I was literally dropping a bottle on the side of the street. Like,
get out my shirt.
Good.
Thank you.
Well, the issue is where we
I think the leapfrog one is where we are right now,
which is the conversation to occur about competing, because they just went to this essentially as part of our board process. But this is pretty, if this is just going to make a call about,
yeah, well, not that I have a little bit of front pressure for information.
So, and I think the key here is not to be picky. ART and me started working together to try to build the wellness thing into the ART measure. I'd almost rather just let this one.
Right. Yeah. We just need to be careful because we called it a related measure. Period. Not related.
Well, but I think what they were saying was 316-361 was a related measure. I don't think we have a
but then they didn't have to. But then we didn't have the discussion about the survival rate. The bottom line about it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, those are it.
Right,
exactly.
Yeah,
But they couldn't discuss
at all.
At all. Okay. So that's where maybe that's my answer.
Okay. And here's what we need to do. We don't need to have the conversation right now.
Yeah.
So we need to take a look at lining up. I don't think this is really possible.
Okay.
Here's what I think we need
to do. But we need to do something. Right. I don't think
we should not. What I think we need to do is give them a measure of regulations on. Because one of the things that he said is just in time to write, we don't have anything else
to
talk about. So, one of the other ones. So, from here to now,
okay, that's fair.
So, we're going to do the call. There's another conversation, and then the call. But I don't think we're going to
make sure. I'll call up the attorney afterwards. And
then,
we'll make sure. So, we just, if anyone has to go, we will have the conversation with the chairman.
But it seems like the thing that's the most valuable, of most value from this group is the discussion as opposed to necessarily signing up on the dotted line on things. So, should I in any way try to triage them and let the ones that we know are most controversial kind of wait till the end?
And
we have to do them all. Right. And so we're going to be leaving some of this call that we have to go clean up, I assume.
Right. But because we don't
So then
what's going to happen is, no. So now we're moving to
So that's just the movement too. And the first thing we do here is that the developers who have measures to be considered have the opportunity to introduce their measures. So this happens before we start into this. And they get a quick opportunity to do that.
And how many of them do we know what on the books?
You know, SPS gets 5 minutes, you know, CMS gets 5 minutes, you know, and Zenith does.
But we don't know what's on the agenda, though. Or are these...
Yeah, these are their measures.
Oh, these are the ones that are being...
Yeah.
I get it. Okay, so it's not a new list.
No, sure enough.
So we let them introduce them before we actually get in.
So what you're going to hear now is an introduction by the developers of all of the things that you're going to hear.
Thank you.
Sure it is.
That's going to be a low standard to live up to there.
So
anybody...
We were talking, I think, before you went out. It's obviously the discussion that I think is worth a while.
Yeah. Isn't that really important? Yeah.
The votes are good.
I mean, the votes are not important, but yeah.
That's it does seem to take more time to vote electronically than it would by showing hands. But I assume they want an exact digital record of it, so it's an efficient way to put information in. But, this thing is going to be a little more complicated than this one.
Right.
A yes, no button. That kind of voting is crazy. It's a big meeting when you say, how many of you use this?
Yeah, I like that.
Kind of ring or something like
right.
that.
Right, yeah.
What's your opinion on this? It's a very interesting bias.
Yeah. Maybe an easy survey. An easy, simple survey.
Could we get underway again, please? Okay, before we get to consideration of candidate measures, Melinda has a comment to make on the prior discussion.
This is just finishing up the discussion that you just had with respect to the esophageal resection measures. What we will do, what we need to do, is be able to get you the full specifications, probably in the form of the measure evaluation for the leapfrog measure, so that you can look at that in terms of best measure evaluation against the two that you just recommended for endorsement. And we'll get that out to you, and we'll have that discussion on a conference call when we talk about the other related and competing measures.
So the consideration of candidate measures will begin with a presentation by the measure developers, and I would ask that we try to be quite concise in this so that we can actually get to some of the measures before our lunch break at 12:40. And so I'm going to follow the order that is on the agenda and begin with the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. I think we have 8 or 9 developers, so we'll start with the STS. And is David, are you going to be the presenter?
Yes. And I can be quite precise. This is quite concise. This is a measure designed to promote the use of beta blockade in the preoperative cardiac surgery patient. Cardiac surgery entails some manipulations of the heart, fluid shifts, electrolyte shifts, use of cardioplegia, cardiopulmonary bypass, and a number of other unique features that result in a particularly high incidence of postoperative atrial fibrillation, which is it can be quite a morbid complication and certainly a costly complication. The use of preoperative beta blockade primarily for this purpose has been a long-standing ACC/AHA class 1 indication. There are now more than 30 randomized trials that show on average a 60% reduction in perioperative atrial fibrillation with the use of preoperative beta blockade. There are other reasons to consider beta blockade in the cardiac surgery patient, including one study by Bruce Ferguson based on several hundred thousand patients in the STS database showing a slight reduction in mortality in patients with ejection fractions over 30%, substantiated by two smaller observational studies. There are 10 randomized trials showing a reduction in the incidence of postoperative VT and VF. This is a measure that where we have considerable room remaining. There is a gap, and there is variability in performance. We have, in our more recent iterations, recognized the fact that there are patients for whom preoperative beta blockade may not be possible for reasons of hemodynamic instability, for example. And we now allow such exclusions if they are documented in the medical chart. Audit of this measure is included as part of our routine audit. And our auditors have found that that there is agreement between the use of contraindications and what's available in the chart to document those reasons in over 95% of cases. So that seems to be working. Now, there may be some concern due to the fact that the recommendations have changed in general surgery. There's been a move away from routine preoperative beta blockade. A little bit different situation. First of all, most of the studies that have shown concern have been studies in which fixed dose agents have been used a very short time before the procedure and without titration, which is clearly not the appropriate way to do it. Very salutary results have been found where patients have been titrated to an optimal heart rate and the agents have been started well in advance. So I don't think that the concerns
David, if I could ask you to be just a little more high level, we have a bunch of these to get through. Any comments on the beta blocker discharge? That seems pretty self-explanatory.
This is preoperative.
No, I'm saying there's a second SDS measure. Any comment on that one?
Same reasoning, except to say that virtually all, by definition, cardiac surgery patients would qualify for one of the ACC AHA recommendations for secondary prevention for use in patients that have MI, unstable angina, angina, heart failure. So there are compelling reasons, not the least of which is long-term survival in a number of studies, to support this measure.
Thanks very much. The next measure is from CMS, and I believe Dale on the telephone is going to be the, presenting as the developer.
Yeah, this is Dale. Pull up my notes. This conversation about beta blocker measure, I want to make sure I've got the right one.
Yeah, the beta blocker measure, surgical patients on beta blocker prior to admission.
Right. So the denominator of this measure is restricted to patients undergoing surgery who are on beta blockers prior to arrival. So the American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association have a class one recommendation for continuing beta blockers in patients who take beta blockers at all. So the denominator population for this performance measure is patients having surgery who take a beta blocker at all. We recently recommended some mild changes to the performance specifications to improve the measure and to reduce the some of the data burden. So the change to the measure now is that the post-op length of stay is greater than or equal to 2 days. And we look to see if the patient received a beta blocker on the day prior to surgery or the day of surgery. So no longer are we requesting a 24-hour time frame. We just simply say, did the patient get the beta blocker either the day before or day of surgery? And also, did they get a beta blocker on either post-op day one or post-op day two. One of the problems with the measure in the past is that hospitals could pass on this metric by simply giving a single dose before surgery. And now, you know, the real focus of the guideline is continued beta blockers in patients who take them at home. So now we'll look to see, did they get a dose the day of or the day before surgery, and if they're in the hospital for greater than 2 days, did they get a dose on either post-op day one or day two?
Thank you. Could you also say a word on the measures on the next page of the agenda? Hair removal, complication rates following arthroplasty, and readmission rates.
Yeah, so I cannot speak either the arthroplasty or the readmission rates. That's not, we don't have responsibility for that measure. Hair removal measure, I think this has been discussed before. This is a measure that I think there's been some discussion about approaching a very high rate of performance. The performance measure basically looks at whether the patient had no hair removal at all for certain operations or use of either dilatory or clippers rather than braces. I can tell you, I don't have the data right in front of me, the national performance rates on the measure are extremely high. I'm pretty sure Wanda has access to that data. And I know there's been some discussion about whether this is a, quote, top-down measure or not.
Okay. Thank you, Dale. It's been suggested to me that Laura Grosso from Yale University might be the developer for the other two CMS measures. Is she present? Okay. All right, let's move on then to the next category, which would be AHRQ, and please cover all the potential measures on this list, if you can, whoever's here from AHRQ.
Yeah, my name is John Bott. I work under contract on site with ARC. In 1 minute or less, yes, these are a number of ARC quality indicators. They're derived from electronic administrative inpatient claims data sets. And these are measures that are annually updated as far as coding, user input, refinements to stay contemporary with the field of measurement. They're freely available to the public in terms of the software and the documentation, which feeds into users being able to provide continued input into the measure. And real quickly, just to apologize for the late arrival of the citations to the measures, as we're in the process of updating the citations for all measures, and we've since prioritized those in MQF maintenance process, and appreciate MQF's allowance for that later arrival of those updated sites. And there's several others when we talk about the RQIs who are here in person as well as on the phone from the RQI team that'll probably be much more responsive to the more technical questions than myself.
Thank you. I skipped Ingenix, the patient 18 of 8 years of age or older on a beta blocker. Is Laura Eaton on the phone from Ingenix?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
We can hear you fine. We can hear you fine.
All right, thank you. Yes, I guess I'll be short. I wanted to point out that we at Ingenix are aware that of the SPS registry measures that NQF currently endorses, and we believe that they are very good measures. Our hope is not to replace the SPS measures, but to actually be seen as a companion measure that would bring added value. We feel that we bring added value in three important ways. We use a different data source. We use claims data, and pharmacy claims data are highly good at capturing prescriptions filled, and we believe that our measure will be good at capturing patient beta blocker use. We also feel that we look at a different aspect of care and measure a different part of the care process continuum. Since the SPS measure uses registry data, its approach could be considered more provider-centric, as in it's capturing more about physicians prescribing behavior. Since our measure can be considered more patient-centric, since we are capturing information about a patient's prescription filling behavior. And then finally, our measure uses administrative claims data, as I mentioned previously. And this type of data is routinely collected for reimbursement, and it's not voluntarily reported, and thus could provide a less biased performance result. Our measure also brings to the table health plans as a user. this administrative claims data is routinely collected by them, and they could benefit from using this measure. I'd also like to say that our measure does not require participating or using our proprietary database. Our proprietary database is used solely to test and create the measure. We put all of our NGOS endorsed measures out in the public domain for anyone to use and apply to their own databases. At the last subcommittee meeting, there was some question about the low cabbage volume that we were picking up. And I just wanted to say that I went back and looked at the data, and there was a problem with some of the code, the programming code. It had to do with we were trying to exclude cabbage patients who were readmitted to an acute or non-acute care facility within 7 days, and it turns out that more than half of our qualified cabbage members were being excluded from the analysis because of a bug in the code. So it drastically brought up our numbers, and initially we were reporting about 731 patients, and now our denominator is 2,303 patients. And so we ended up with a new compliance rate of approximately 91.5%. I just wanted to make sure that I brought that to the community's attention because it was a big concern at the last meeting.
Thank you. The next set of measures are from the ASC Quality Collaboration. We have two representatives here.
Good morning. I'm Donna Swasberg. I'm the Executive Director of the ASCQC, and this is Dr. David Shapiro with me. I'm going to take a little different track. I just wanted to make sure everybody's aware about the ambulatory side. The collaboration was formed in 2006 to develop standardized measures for the ASC specifically. It's a group of management companies, professional association, and accrediting bodies. Something that's a little different is that our measures the consensus was that our measures needed to be within the scope, influence, and control of the ASC. We didn't limit these to any particular patient population to allow all ASCs to participate. I also wanted everyone to understand that we've tried to harmonize our measures. However, you need to take into account that ASCs are different than inpatient hospitals. The code set for billing, hospitals use ICD-9, ASCs use CDTs. The claim format, hospitals use UB04s, ASCs use CMS 1500s. And our patient population is typically ASA 1 or 2, so they're already in our minds risk adjusted. To date, just so everybody's aware, CMS has not implemented a quality reporting system for ASCs. So all the work that we're doing is basically voluntary reporting. We also have public reporting on our website, on our measures. And ASCs were not included in the EMR incentive program. We're presenting three measures today for maintenance. Two are process measures, and they're in accordance with the surgical site prevention guidelines, IV antibiotic timing, and appropriate surgical hair removal. I'm sorry, the IV antibiotic is tomorrow. And then our third measure is hospital transfer admission. It's an outcomes measure. We did harmonize the IV antibiotic and the hair removal measure with the SCIT measures as best as we could. We do have our results and our data from about 1,300 ASCs on our website. It's out there for other ASCs to benchmark. And there's about 5,200 ASCs in the country, but again, these 1,300 are doing this voluntarily. David, do you have any comments?
Thank you again for having us here to present these three measures for maintenance with you today. I think Donna touched on the two probably most important aspects of why we would like you to consider our measures in possibly a slightly different light than you might others. One is that they really are important to the ASC industry. This is a voluntary project that we've undertaken without to date any federal requirement for quality reporting, and we have done so with your help, and I want to again thank you for endorsing the measures that you have in the past. The measures really do warrant continued attention from us within our industry, even though they may not meet all the statistical criteria that we would like eventually to be able to apply to them by furthering our data gathering techniques. And the other thing is just a general comment on the ASC industry, which we're glad to talk more about in specific relation to our measures. But in many instances, although we do comparable services, we are, for reasons, including those that Donna Slosberg mentioned and others, we are comparable but not identical to the HOPD. So I think when we start talking about harmonization of our measures, we will be able to give you a little bit more background as to why we have been, in some cases, unable to harmonize to the extent that even we would like to harmonize our measures with already existing ones for other sites of service. So I'll wait till we've discussed our measures, but again, I want to thank you for your support in the past and hope that we continue to be able to work together on these measures and move forward. Thanks.
Thank you. The Society of Vascular Surgery.
It won't be until 1:30.
It will not be until 1:30. Okay. American College of Cardiology Foundation follow-up assessment of stroke or death after carotid. They were going to be attending the meeting. No one here from the ACC? Okay. Children's Hospital of Pennsylvania, of Philadelphia, rather. Same outcome. I think that's it. We asked, yeah. No one there. Any other developers that have measures for consideration? No. So let's then go back to the agenda.
Excuse me, this is Laura Grasso calling from Yale University. They called for our measure a while ago. I'm actually on the train. I'm presenting measures 1550 and 1551. And I'm wondering, I was expecting to give the summary at 3:45. Would it be okay to give the brief summary when I'm there at 3:45?
I think that would be fine.
Okay. Great. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So let's now go to back to the agenda, top of page 3, measure 127, preoperative beta blockade, and we will start with the lead reviewer, Paula Grayling.
Okay. I'm speaking for work group A, and we had just a few comments related to this measure. It is a part of the STS CABG composite score. We felt that there was very strong evidence to support the measure and that we could see a clearly demonstrated performance gap. We did have some concerns related to the contraindications, and actually STS provided us with that additional document that helps to update those concerns. Feasibility was certainly still a question. We recognize that the cost of data abstraction or data abstraction manager is present, as we've spoken about several of the other measures before. And we do recognize that there is some possible opportunity for harmonization as we consider all of the beta block measures that come before us. And that's really it.
Any other discussion on this measure? Hearing none, if we could vote on first on importance. Thank you. I have to read it out. 21 yes, 0 no. So scientific acceptability, we now have a more complex vote here. 1 through 4, completely, partially, minimally, not at all. What is our numerator here? Is it 21? If everyone could press again. Sixteen completely, five partially, no minimally, no, not at all. Usability, same scale. Still shy one vote. Seventeen completely, four partially. If I could ask the staff who might be more knowledgeable in the technology here, if we just keep submitting votes until we hit 21, will that unload or overload or confuse the system if everyone just keeps voting until we hit 21?
No, it should be fine. It only counts each vote one.
So let's do that. Just keep hitting your votes until we hit 21. We might save 20 seconds a vote here. So, feasibility. Seventeen completely, four partially. Let's see if we can get it under 10 seconds this time and have a new record. Does this measure meet all the NQF criteria for endorsement? We're back to a 1-2-3 vote here. Wow. Okay, the next, are we done with that one? 21 yes, 0 no. Okay, so we're done with that measure, and Paula, you have 0284.
Yes, that one also. 0284 is surgery patients on beta blockers prior to admission who received a beta blocker during the perioperative period. This is a CMS skip measure, and you'll recognize that it's not just limited to CABG, it is indeed surgery patients. Some of our original questions related to the timing of the perioperative period, and I think Dr. Brasler discuss that in terms of looking at from day of surgery to post-op day two. We also had a question about the denominator definition, and you'll notice in the definition that laparoscopy is identified in those lists, and we were wondered why laparoscopes were just pulled out of that denominator, and perhaps he can address that for us. Finally, there were some questions related to the collection methodology. It talked about getting the information from the medical record, and we wanted some clarity about paper versus electronic or both. And then finally, they did a nice job in terms of listing the disparities at the back of the application, but perhaps that they could address some of their disparity comments.
So there was quite a bit of discussion about this measure on the call. I will point out that this is only for patients who are on beta blockers prior to admission. That confused me a little bit when I was thinking about it. Is there any discussion that you'd like to bring here?
Yeah, I just wanted to chime in about the laparoscopic part of things. We've had this discussion previously about prophylaxis for VTE and everything else. And I think it just reflects kind of older ideas about laparoscopy, but as we look now, one of the most common iterations is for bariatric surgery, where a lot of patients may be actually on beta blockade prior to surgery, hypertension occurring about 70% of those patients. So I would highly suggest making sure that laparoscopy is not excluded from this, particularly vis-a-vis the bariatric surgery laparoscopic patients.
I believe Dr. Brett just signed off. I can tell you this is Wanda Johnson from OFMQ. The laparoscope exclusion is being removed starting with January 2012. And so that exclusion will not be counted with this measure. We do only collect chart obstructive measures. Currently, we are in the process of updating specifications so that it can be collected via EHRs.
One question that I had is the denominator is defined in terms of surgery patients on beta blocker therapy prior to arrival, but prior to arrival is not defined. Is that a year ago, a month ago, a day ago, a week ago? And I couldn't find a definition, and it seemed like it would make a big difference.
I think that was discussed on the call. Could one of the developers comment?
Sure. In the data element, beta blocker current medication, which is how the abstractors determine whether it was considered a prior to arrival, it has to be listed as a home or a current medication. It must be documented that they were on it prior to arrival, that it wasn't started while they were in the hospital. And if it's taken for a non-cardiac reason, then they would answer no to current medication, so they wouldn't be in the denominator.
I guess I'd throw in that the other discussion that occurred on the call was the vagueness of the criteria around what constituted a perioperative beta blocker, I think that the the vagueness in terms of what the dose, route of administration, et cetera, would mean, and I think the way that discussion was resolved was that greater specificity just resulted in greater complexity and measurement burden. And that just the threshold of was a beta blocker administered was the only way to do this simply.
But she just said that it was for non-cardiac reasons. So how is that determined?
It has to be documented that it was non-cardiac for them to answer no. So that's just one of the outs that we allow them to have. Say they were taking it for migraine. It has to be documented that it was for a non-cardiac reason, taken at home, and then they could answer no to beta blocker current medication, and they wouldn't be in the measured denominator.
So what if they were just taking it for hypertension? Because those patients often also have coexisting cardiac disease.
They would answer yes, and they would be considered for this measure.
Just to add on to what Dr. Solchani was saying, one of the problems that I had with this measure was that overall just having a beta blocker on in the periop period hasn't been shown to be beneficial if it's not titrated to a certain heart rate. And I understand that for measurement purposes that is going to be a lot more difficult to capture, but perhaps at a future date as we move towards EHRs that the measure developers can think about how to include that. Because if we do want to improve the quality of care, just having metoprolol at a low dose on isn't really going to be beneficial if it's not titrated.
We'll take the recommendations to the selection panel. They do have exclusion if they are bradycardic. With a heart rate less than 50, then they would answer that there's a reason for not administering. But yes, titration is something that we can address with the test.
Any other discussion before we vote?
The one other thing would be a recommendation to some of the things that have just been discussed don't seem to be in the write-up in terms of excluding patients who are on a beta blocker for other than cardiac reasons, exclusion for bradycardia. Those are not listed as exclusions, and it seems like those are pretty important and should be.
It's because they're listed in the data element reasons for not administering and And we will try to do a better job getting those exclusions spelled out instead of just listing the data elements.
Okay, so first vote is importance to measure. Remember, just keep pushing the button until it gets to 21. Did someone leave the room? I don't think so. One in favor. Second vote is scientific acceptability. Here we're voting on the 1-4 scale. Ten completely, ten partially, one minimally. Usability on the 1-4 scale. Twelve completely, nine partially. Feasibility on the 1-4 scale. There's definitely one in here that's not working. 12 completely, 9 partially. Does the measure meet all the NQF criteria for endorsement? Yes, no, or abstain. Yes, two no. Okay, the next one, beta blocker at discharge. Dr. Stafford?
Yeah, that's fine. This is beta blockade at discharge and isolated CABG, just so everybody understands that that's what the measure was about. In terms of importance to measure, everybody in the group really felt that it was important to measure that there's clearly a performance gap. But even though the mean was high, the median showed that a fair number were off the scale and still needed to be measured. So we all felt it was important to measure. In the discussion about scientific acceptability, there were some questions about patients with contraindications who were removed from both the numerator and denominator, and also the time windows, and those were pretty much cleared up in the phone call with the developer. I don't think there were any big issues that I can recall. Everybody felt that, for the most part, usability was not much of an issue. And feasibility, there were questions about cost for data abstraction that were answered. Lots of questions that got around, again, gaming the system and whatnot, but pretty much these are things that are going to occur with a lot of the measures that we have, and everybody felt that this was at least a measure that the outcome measure was relatively related to the process measure, and so from that standpoint, we felt it was a good measure to have.
Comments or further discussion?
There was a question in the work group discussion that the group, I thought, felt Dr. Sheehan could answer about why no risk adjustment.
Well, I think for process measures, typically exclusions and eligibility requirements generally take the place of risk adjustment. I think it would be difficult to construct a risk adjustment model for this, although some people have advocated using risk adjustment for process measures, but I think in general, eligibility and exclusion criteria have been used instead.
Okay, let's vote on this. Importance to measure, yes, no, or abstain. Anyone in favor? Scientific acceptability on the 1-4 scale. Completely, three partially. If I could ask again a technical question, do you have to hit send every time you hit the number if you're voting repeatedly?
You have to hit send.
Okay, so it takes two fingers to do this to keep it going.
I've never done it.
Well, you probably only got one vote in then. So hit 1, 2, 3, or 4 and send until you see 21 up there, and maybe we'll get under 10 seconds consistently in it. Usability, scale of 1-4. Seventeen completely, 4 partially. Feasibility, scale of 1-4. Eighteen completely, 3 partially. Does the measure meet the NQF criteria for endorsement? Yes, no, abstain. Okay. 21 yes. Where is the antenna actually located that's receiving this? It's on your computer? Okay. We can't ask to put you in the middle of the room. I think that would be unfair. Okay. Next measure is 1480, the Ingenix measure that we heard about, patients 18 years or older, and Dr. Stafford again.
This measure led to a lot more discussion. Again, I think everybody said, well, isn't this really related to the previous measure, and should this somehow be harmonized, was one of the questions that did come up for the group. Everybody felt, again, that it was important to measure beta blocker use in this patient population. So from an important standpoint, everybody felt that it was was reasonable. As to the scientific acceptability, there were lots of questions. Some of those were addressed today about the population, and particularly the numbers of CABGs that were actually included in the group. And clearly, that was something that we picked up on, and they found actually was a bug in their computer system. It still isn't clear to me, at least hearing what we got from the developer today, whether those numbers are still high enough for us, at least for me, thinking about it. There were similarly other discussions about this being a proprietary database and therefore only applies to people that actually have insurance benefits. And so there may be a large number of patients in the population, particularly in the Medicare and Medicaid population, where this may not apply and so may not be generalizable to the large population that we would like to see the measure looked at. The flip side of that discussion was is that for health plans, it would be usable because it was another way for them to get that information. Those were really the two biggest things about the database. As to the feasibility, it varied from minimally to completely, and again, it depended on what patient population people wanted to look at.
Other comments?
How's it going to be attributed?
What was the question?
Well, whose scorecard is this going to go on? The hospitals? The physicians? The cardiac surgeon can give a prescription for a beta blocker. The hospital can give a prescription for a beta blocker. The health system can give a prescription for a beta blocker, but if the patient doesn't fill the prescription for the beta blocker, where's this data? Who's going to make the performance measure? Who's going to improve it? Who's the audience to change to get quality?
Exactly, and there was a lot of discussion about that, whether this would be used for internal benchmarking in health plans versus external benchmarking. How would people use that? And it was interesting because originally we all thought that it meant people would actually have filled the prescription, but after further discussion, it was actually just that there was a prescription written. They didn't actually have to have gotten it filled. So it doesn't even really get to what we would all like to measure, is did they actually get the drug and did they actually take it?
In that case, isn't it the same as prescription at discharge?
Yeah. It's just they're looking at a different population.
This is the developer. Could I just make a comment? Yes, when we spoke last time, we did talk about codes that were for prescriptions written. However, there's no problem with us taking out those codes and have it only strictly represent pharmacy claims that have been filled. We just initially put them in there because we were trying to make it as consistent with SPS as possible.
I think what I would say, the other issue that came up on the call in response to this line of question was that the fact that this comes off a different data set and a publicly accessible data set was seen as one of the selling points and sort of complementary values of this measure above and beyond the STS measure. So the way that I sort of walked away in thinking about this was that it represented a different look from a different perspective and a different population, that it potentially had the value that it could go to claims that are prescriptions that were actually filled, but that it had the disadvantage that it was a very narrow subset of the total CABG population, which is more than half Medicare, and that it was at least originally was probably not terribly accurate in identifying those patients. It sounds like that accuracy has been tightened up, although I agree with Dr. Stafford, I'm not exactly sure that we know to what degree it's been tightened up.
I would also say if you just look at prescriptions filled, since a lot of these patients come in on beta blockers, they may go back to taking their own beta blockers and not fill a prescription afterwards. So it doesn't mean that they're not taking it.
Have we seen the revised data? I think seeing the numbers is important to understanding what this measure is getting at.
You're referring to the new denominators that I talked about this earlier?
Yes, well, the new denominator and then the rate. All of the results that we'd seen originally apparently aren't valid, so what does the data show?
Okay, no, I haven't submitted that. I definitely can. What What we did find was that there was about 2,300 patients in the denominator and 2,100 patients in the numerator, giving us a compliance rate of 91.5%.
I also have a question I didn't see specifically, is how are you defining that a prescription was given? Is it just that it's on the, you know, going out medication reconciliation? Or how is it being defined?
It was being defined through CPT code. Beta blocker therapy prescribed, which I believe is 4006F. That's what it was going out after. But that's the code that I suggested that we can remove from it and just have it strictly be pharmacy claims data, official pharmacy claims data.
So if it's based on outpatient pharmacy claims data, then that means they had to fill it.
Right.
Okay.
So I go back to my original point. Is that patients may already be on beta blockers, and then they will not be filling a new prescription because they already have medications. Certainly not within 7 days. They may fill it later on, but then you're going to ding people for things that may not be an issue.
Yes, you're right. So our compliance rate went up, so I guess the bottom line is that you're right. That is something to consider.
Just one clarification. Actually, in the measure submission form, this is how I burst it, it specifically says that there's, you have to fulfill at least one of the three criteria, one of which is you filled a prescription, so it is prescription filled, within 7 days, 7 days after hospital discharge. Two, to try to claim for that, and a beta blocker prescribed in the 35 days prior, so that might answer a part of your concerns. And three, if the patient had a claim with a procedure code of beta blocker discharge. So that's the only one she's mentioning, but in fact there are two others that she's not talking about that I think address what you're saying.
Well, it sounds like a number of things have changed from what I think we were just told, that the HCPCS codes were no longer in, but at this point I'm confused about what's in the measure, what's changed, what the results are. I'm not quite sure what we've got.
I would have to agree with that, and if I were to vote right now on this measure as it stands, without all of the other qualifications that we've heard, I would say it's not important to measure. So I would request that we either table this and come back and rediscuss it, or we vote on the measure as it stands.
So if you're looking at tabling it for discussion at a later time, what you need to do is say, in addition to what you just said in terms of information that you need in order to properly consider the measure, and so you could table it to do that. There were a couple of other things that during the work group were discussed that I don't think you've mentioned, and one was some question about the adequacy of the validity testing and whether or not you were comfortable with that at this point. And another one, I think, with respect to the plan for public reporting, there was a question about that in terms of the extent to which public reporting would occur. So I'm just saying that. So if there are conditions that you want to apply for later consideration, it's probably time to articulate all of them.
I think I'm the one that raised the issues about validity testing. And for those of you that didn't go through all the fine print, the validity testing related to public reporting consisted of surveying two customers. Well, customers aren't the public, and two isn't a very big number. So I certainly was not comfortable that that criterion was met.
Dr. Dutton commented on the validity issues as well.
If we table it, we're somehow saying that it seems to be a useful measure and we want to bring it back to make it robust and better. My fundamental thought is I don't think this is a useful measure, so why don't we just put it out of its misery?
For clarification, this is not a publicly reported measure. Or is it?
Doesn't it have to be?
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah. I was just confused by the discussion there.
So let's have a little further discussion on the table versus a voted up or down. I guess if the vote up or down would be just to say we'll keep it alive for further consideration versus we don't think this is under any circumstance going to lead to a valuable new measure. That vote obviously isn't up on the slides, but we could do that perhaps by a show of hands if that's a acceptable process step to take.
And from what I remember, this is very similar to the lipid lowering agent proposal at the last meeting by the same company, which I think we did quote kind of put out of its misery, if I'm right. We could clarify that though.
I think so. So the critical question is, from what you have heard and from the additional information that you've gotten in terms of changes and updates, would it be useful for you to see that additional and or corrected information prior to going to the vote about the importance of the measure, or do you feel confident that you understand what that is and comfortable with proceeding to a vote without that? And I would say that you would really only be able to go beyond importance if you got the additional and corrected information. Otherwise, you would not be voting on current specifications.
I think this issue highlights a problem we have with some other measures that we'll look at, which really has to do with follow-up over and where patients go after they leave the hospital environment where the records are easily available. And although this may not be a perfect measure, it does help us address that period of time after the acute event has occurred, which is a challenge on all long-term follow-ups. I mean, Ingenix is a large database. It's not comprehensive. It doesn't have everybody. But it's a very good start to answer questions that I think are important. And in the context of what they do, it probably works reasonably well. So I just think we have to keep that in mind, because long-term follow-up is a challenge that we're going to face on all of our measures. It's one thing to do something in a hospital. It's quite another to know what happens to those patients a week, a month, or 6 months later. And this is a step in that direction. So I think that we shouldn't dismiss it out of hand. It may not be perfect, but it is, I think, valuable.
Well, I would agree with you on some of those points. One of the sidebar discussions we had earlier out in the hallway was, I think, understanding the impact of what putting the NQF stamp on these measures has long-term for people. So by putting the stamp on a measure, that gives it some street cred elsewhere with groups like CMS or JCO to pick up that measure and then require that people use it. So I think you have to be careful, and we really need to think about what we're doing when we put an endorsement on a measure. NQF endorses the measures. They don't monitor them in terms of implementation. They don't force implementation. But the fact of the matter is, that's the effect that the NQF endorsement has, and I think we need to be really careful about endorsing measures that really don't broadly cover a large population. I understand your point about the long-term follow-up. I'm not sure this is the best way to do it.
It may not be, but it also cuts both ways. We have, in this relates to the discussion that I prompted the last meeting, having the NQF approve measures which actually are, if not toothless, have less value in the context our ability to get more information. So we just approved, for instance, mortality measures in cardiac surgery, when in fact that may not be a particularly useful measure, and there was more information available which would be valuable. So the NQF has just put a stamp on something for the next 3 years, which will be, I think, woefully behind the times. So it cuts both ways.
Coming from the perspective of a health plan, having administrative measures, being able to measure the care provided by, you know, for the health plan members by health plan providers is really useful. What makes me so uncomfortable about this measure is there's 15 million members in the database, and I believe that Ingenix said that there were 2,200 members identified with bypass surgery. Now, this measure is limited, I believe, to members with a pharmacy benefit. I'm going to make a rough guess that 5 million of the people have a pharmacy benefit. So that's around 400 people per million, which compared to our data, and I pulled our data to see, is probably about, for our commercial population under age 65, which matches up with this measure, looks to me like maybe they're finding half the people that I would expect to have had a bypass. So again, you know, the numbers make a difference. It also, if you're finding 500 patients per million, what's the use of the measure? Are we looking at the health plan level? Well, if the health plan level 500 members is okay if I have a million members. If I'm breaking that down by hospital or by doctor, you end up with numbers that are so small that you somehow add credibility to, I'm reporting on your 13 measures who were in my health plan and had a pharmacy benefit, and I'm reporting for another doctor on his 23 members. And that isn't useful. And that's the thing that bothers me, is that if you break it down by provider, the numbers won't be big enough to be useful.
So I'm going to take the prerogative of calling the question here since we're over time. So I think we can address this actually with the vote on importance. So if we vote importance up, then we'll proceed to the other criteria and ask that the measure be optimized. If we vote importance down, I think the topic is closed for today at least. So let's do that vote. It's a yes or a no. So I think that's a fairly definitive no on that question. So we will wrap up the voting on that item. Now, before we break for lunch, we have a required public comment. Should we hold that for later, Melinda, or should we do that prior to lunch? Okay. NQF member public comment. Those on the phone or in the room. Hearing none, we will go to lunch. Lunch break is 1/2 an hour. Lunch is outside.